Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The list of things to do in Seattle is long.
If you're looking for a place to live in a predominantly white neighborhood, you'll see words like vintage charm and classic to describe an apartment. In a neighborhood with more people of color, the words safe and secure and convenient to transportation are more likely to come up. The UW researchers, who combed through 45,000 Craigslist rental ads in Seattle, Tacoma, and Bellevue, say although the ads aren't overtly or consciously racist, they do help reinforce perceptions of neighborhoods. They say when an apartment is advertised as safe and secure, it implies the surrounding neighborhood isn't. In contrast, they found the words and phrases used to advertise rentals in white neighborhoods tended to imply the community was a good place to be, the emphasis on walkability and access to nearby cultural amenities. Seattle had a long history of racist redlining, of making sections of the city off-limits to people of color. The UW researchers say while those restrictions are gone, segregation continues in part because of how neighborhoods are perceived. Paula Wissel, KNKX News.
Why haven't you learned anything?
This is Northwest News from KNKX. I'm Ashley Gross. Students in the Highline District south of Seattle are pushing for youth representation on committees that hire teachers. This is one example of a wave of activism among high school students around issues of racial justice. Students around the region have advocated for police officers to be removed from schools, and a new student group in Highline wants youth to have a say in hiring educators.
A lot of us are seniors, and it just kind of felt like the right time to just get it going before we leave, just so we can leave behind a legacy for other students who are coming in.
Jordan Famimiko is 17 years old and attends Raisbeck Aviation High School in Tukwila. She's president of her school's Black Student Union and one of the students involved in the new group, Highline Youth Race and Equity Coalition. Jordan says it's critically important to get a more diverse teaching staff. Students at Highline are overwhelmingly youth of color. Three quarters of teachers are white.
I feel like students on every level need to feel safe. They need to feel valuable. And it's not to say that minority students can't connect with their white teachers. However, just right off the bat, there is some disconnect there, just culturally.
The new student group met recently with Superintendent Susan Enfield. Mary Belay is 17 years old and attends Mount Rainier High School in Des Moines. She's an officer in her school's Black Student Union. She says the protests this summer have inspired her peers to join her in pushing for change.
Being Black in America, you definitely have seen these issues your entire life, but it was just kind of all of a sudden it blew up to this point where, like, not only did I see it, but everyone around me is starting to also join in on this movement.
Highline District spokesperson Catherine Carboni-Rogers said in an email that the district has included students on hiring teams for principals and is now considering ways to give students a role in the teacher hiring process. She says Highline has made progress in diversifying its teaching and administrative staff, but still has a ways to go. Ashley Gross, KNKX News.
The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell. Hi-ho, the derry-o, the farmer in the dell.
Now let's meet the family behind Triple J Farm in upstate New York. They farm with a mantra, making farmers black again. Here's Jillian Forstat from member station WSKG.
85-year-old James Minton owns a chicken farm. It's small, just 20 acres and nearly 300 chickens. There's a patch of maple trees where Minton makes syrup each winter and a pond stocked full of fish. That's where his youngest great-granddaughters like to play. In all, Minton has 28 grandchildren, 40 great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. He says he bought this land for them.
Well, there'd be some place for them to come at any time. If something bad happened to them in the city and they need some place to stay, whether I'm alive or dead, this place would still be here.
Most of his family lives in New York City. It's not often they get to be around cows or chickens.
They'll just chicken away blue eggs. And there we go. There we go.
Minton bought the land a decade ago when he retired and wanted a place of his own. Now, he's growing the farm business with his grandchildren. Last year, his grandson, Daryl Minton, moved upstate to help manage the farm. Since, they've gone from selling 30 dozen eggs every couple of months to selling close to 200 dozen each week.
We're going to have a contest. We're going to have our customers name all our chickens. So.
Minton says before he started living with his grandfather, he worked for a big grocery chain in New York City. There, he was building wealth for someone else.
At the end of the day, that didn't make any sense. Like, why couldn't me and my family use the things that we know and try to build our own wealth, or build the wealth to help my grandfather out?
Black Americans own 1% of rural land nationwide and make up only 139 of the roughly 58,000 farmers in New York State. Black farmers have historically faced lending discrimination when applying for loans from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Without access to capital, young farmers won't be able to buy or maintain land. There is a growing movement of young farmers led by people of color in the Northeast, but few have the same advantages Minton did. He saved up over years of working, had money in stocks, and a 401k that covered the initial costs of the land.
I didn't have to, go borrow money from this one to pay for the property, which I had the first initial payment for the property.
The family knows they've had a rare chance, one many of their neighbors won't get. It's one of the reasons they're stamping their egg cartons with hashtag buy land and make farmers black again. Black Americans were promised 40 acres and a mule after emancipation. Daryl Minton says, why not give them 40 acres and a tractor now?
It wouldn't make it right, but it would just definitely even the playing field. You know, give people a hands up. It's not like you're giving them tools to destroy the country. You're actually giving them tools to help build the country.
Minton says they'll be successful once they can get to selling 1,000 dozen eggs each week. But to him and his grandfather, James Minton, success also looks like having a place the youngest family members can learn to care for the animals and the land.
Just to see everybody together, it's just, you seem like you accomplished something.
Passing down the land through generations. That's a task the family is proud to carry on. For NPR News, I'm Jillian Forstad in Windsor, New York.
What'd they give you, blood?
3 months, man.
What you doing in here anyway? You ought to be home with your mama. How old are you, boy?
13.
Damn. The bastards must be running out of niggas to arrest.
When the pandemic hit, prisons across the U.S. canceled visitations for safety reasons. It's been hard on prisoners. It's been hard on their families, but phone calls, letters, and packages help keep them connected. Jessica Salinas is an advocate for her brother Christian, who is in a state prison near Sacramento. She is worried that recent cuts to the Postal Service will make staying in touch even harder. Jessica Salinas joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Lulu. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. First off, your brother is in an area that's currently being impacted by the wildfires. How is he?
Thankfully, he's okay. I heard from him yesterday, but they're evacuating everyone except for the prisons. So it's definitely a high anxiety time for us.
And may I ask what crime sent your brother Christian to prison?
So he was sentenced for armed robbery when he was 23. So he's considered a youth offender.
Okay. How often were you and your family visiting your brother before COVID-19?
We would make the effort to go out once a month. My parents and my family live in Texas. I currently live in Los Angeles. So we would fly out to the Bay Area and then drive the hour and a half to Vacaville.
And when was the last time you were able to see him?
February 22nd.
May I ask you, how do you stay in touch now?
Our main source of communication is phone calls and letters.
How much do phone calls cost in comparison to staying in touch by mail?
Oh, man. So I actually did the math. It averaged out to, I believe, 32 cents per minute that I spend. So they're only allowed 15-minute phone calls. And obviously, the providers take a fee, and then we're charged per minute as well, versus a letter, which is 65 cents per stamp.
So mail is really essential just to keep that connection.
It is critical, I think, to stay in contact. I actually got some quotes from people inside, as well as from other family members. I'm part of this community of women, mostly wives, mothers, and sisters of those inside. And overwhelmingly, everyone said that the mail service is essential and critical, and sometimes the only outlet that they have to stay in communication to family members.
Because it's not just writing letters, right? It's also packages and other things to make life more bearable.
Correct. So we use the USPS to send pictures, really important documents like parole documents, because as you know, technology is not well integrated into prisons. One, they're not allowed to have cell phones. There are no video calls, but there's also no way to email or really fax important documents. And mail is that medium.
Have you had reports of delays in getting mail and packages yet?
Yes, so it's varied. So in my conversations with these family members and in our personal, it really depends on the location, it seems like. So some have said they haven't noticed a delay yet, and others who are farther away from where their loved one is incarcerated have started to notice a couple weeks delay.
There are going to be listeners out there who might hear about the crime that Christian committed and say, why should I care if he doesn't have access to cheap phone calls or on-time mail delivery? What would you respond to that?
At a larger structural system level, I would say that it should matter to all of us how we treat our most vulnerable, including those that are incarcerated. Lots of great institutions across the nation have time and time again put out data that says that staying in close contact with family and loved ones outside and this constant communication leads to more positive outcomes post-release, as well as lower recidivism rates, which again is great for us at an individual level, but also us as a community.
Jessica Salinas of Los Angeles, California, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lulu.
White supremacy is the sickness.
Of the COVID cases reported in the United States, half are among Black and Latino people. And yet, in vaccine trials underway, only 15% of the participants are non-white. That could make a big difference in both how accurate vaccine studies are and also how fast a vaccine gets to the public. For more on this, we're joined by Renee Mahaffey-Harris, president of the Center for Closing the Health Gap in Cincinnati. Good morning.
Good morning, Lulu.
So you are not a doctor, but you do work in the health space. So what is your understanding of why it is so important to include a representative population in a vaccine trial?
Due to the fact that COVID-19 has had a disproportionate impact to Black and Latino people across this country, it is more paramount than ever that the trials be reflective of a bigger proportion of Black and Latino people. Many drugs in our country, frankly, we are not in those trials. And so what you're beginning to see articles on is that the effects of that drug is not necessarily having the same impact that it should.
There is a hurdle here, though, right? Because Black and Latino people are more unwilling to enroll in trials. Why is that?
History. For the Black community in particular, it's the Tuskegee experiment, the syphilis experiment in which, you know, Black people were infected with a disease without their consent.
People have that in their mind.
People have that in their mind, and they feel that we are guinea pigs. And so when people start talking about research or drug trials or clinical trials, there is an immediate hand up, no, I'm not going to participate, because there is just a true mistrust of the medical and healthcare systems.
So you were asked by one of the companies conducting vaccine trials to help them enroll more minorities. What did you say to them?
The response is, we need to know more. I'd want to know, you know, the three phases of research and trial development and understand what the representation has been in development of the trial. As so often happens, we are contacted to be participants, but perhaps not included in the actual development of the trial. I would want to make sure that there are opportunities for people to understand what a clinical trial is, what this clinical trial in particular will do, and why it's important for us to be representative in the participation in the trial.
Let's say you decide that this is something worth doing. How do you then sell it to your community? I mean, I've seen stories about doctors going to Target and Walmart trying to sort of recruit Latinos and African Americans to be part of the trial. That seems a bit of a scattershot approach. What do you think needs to happen more systemically to have people have faith that if they participate, they will be treated fairly and that there is transparency there?
Information is king. And I don't believe that it is fair to go to places like Target and saying, hey, join this trial. I think it needs to start with working with organizations that are trusted in the Black and Latino communities to hold information sessions and Q&A and build some trust of sharing of information. I don't know that those kind of conversations have taken place.
What it brings to mind, though, if the ask is to be more inclusive and thoughtful, that you need more Black doctors, more Latino doctors and researchers, so that these communities aren't just brought in on the back end.
I think that's my biggest concern that I was not aware of until I talked to the Cincinnati Medical Association's president, Dr. Roosevelt Walker. And he said to me, we are all being asked about helping get people recruited for the trial, but we weren't representative in the creation of the trial, especially now more than ever with the murder of George Floyd and the elevation and activation of the fight against injustice and social justice in our country. Race is a construct in health. Race is a construct in our lives. And so we have to ensure that there is representation. Less than 4% of physicians in this country are Black or Latino. Right? 4%. That doesn't mean that we can't be representative of the early part of creating the trial.
That's Renee Mahaffey-Harris, president of the Center for Closing the Health Gap in Cincinnati. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lulu.
Wasn't voted for Barack Obama.
4 years ago, older white voters played a big role in helping elect President Trump. But some polls now suggest Joe Biden is making inroads with seniors, in part because of Trump's handling of the coronavirus. Still, many of these older, more conservative voters say they're deeply conflicted about how to vote this November. Some tell NPR they're sticking with Trump. NPR's Brian Mann has more.
America's population gets more diverse every year, a trend that mostly favors Democrats, which is why older white voters are so important to Donald Trump. Robert Griffin with the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group says Trump actually needs even more support from seniors to win a second term.
It's not just that Trump had to sort of hold steady. He actually had to increase his margins a bit relative to 2016. Again, just given how the country is changing demographically.
President Trump's victory in some battleground states in 2016 was razor thin. So losing even a little support from older white voters in, say, Florida or Pennsylvania could cost him big. And Joe Biden is working hard to make that happen. Here's one of the Democrats' ads featuring a retired voter named Donna talking about the impact of COVID-19 on seniors.
While I don't blame Donald Trump for the virus, I blame him for his lack of action.
The group Republican Voters Against Trump is webcasting testimonials from older Republicans, voters like Joseph in Florida, who say they're switching to Biden.
It's okay that we voted for Donald Trump in the first election. We now have seen what he can do, and especially what he can't do.
Polls suggest more seniors are feeling this way. So NPR reached out to a random group of older voters who cast ballots for Trump in 2016. Many told us they are deeply troubled by the president's behavior. Marty Stango is 77 years old and lives near Jacksonville, Florida.
He's not exactly the most trustworthy individual, nor, in fact, does he always tell the truth. He definitely will throw out things that are absolute lies.
And here's Doris Harrington. She's 82 and lives in Des Moines, Iowa.
I don't want to judge other people, but I really don't think his character is great. You know, his morals are not my morals.
We heard this again and again. A lot of seniors who backed Trump 4 years ago say they're really tired of his tweets. They hate his use of profanity, and many rate him poorly on his handling of the coronavirus. But NPR heard something else from these voters, a reminder just how hard it is these days to actually change people's votes. Marty Stango in Florida, who thinks Trump's a liar, he's not switching to Joe Biden.
Right now, at least, for Trump.
Doris Harrington in Des Moines agrees. For all her misgivings about Trump, she's actually enthusiastic about his second term.
Trump, even though his character might be bad, he is supporting religious freedom, religious rights, right to life. The Democratic Party are not.
A lot of older Trump voters told NPR they like Joe Biden, but they think his party has moved too far to the left. This is a voting bloc that's far more white and rural than the country as a whole. And many told NPR they're troubled by Democrats' embrace of the Black Lives Matter movement. Robin Tunnell, who's 64 and lives in Midlothian, Texas, told us she thinks Trump is unpresidential and a bully, but he shares her views on race.
I just don't understand this kneeling for the flag. I think that that is just horrible. And he would never do that. Trump would never do that.
NPR did find some older white Trump voters who say his behavior has caused them to waver. They're giving Biden a serious look. Michael Barbone, who's on the edge of this senior voting group at age 59, lives in Odessa, Florida.
Today, I would vote for Donald Trump, but the strength of my confidence is waning, so it could definitely change.
Pollster Robert Griffin says the data doesn't suggest a huge shift among seniors who voted for Trump, but he thinks it's clear there is enough softening of support to put Trump's reelection at risk.
The reality that it's happened appears to be confirmed by a lot of different pollsters. That's really problematic for him.
But the polling data and NPR's interview suggest this is one key group of voters still in play, still reachable by both sides with just over 2 months to Election Day. Brian Mann, NPR News.
The first thing we're going to do to, I think, stop racism is stop focusing on racism.
Stop focusing on racism.
The police shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin, further intensified our national attention on race. We're deep into a summer of arguments over that subject. They coincide with the re-election campaign of the president, whose rhetoric includes frequent attacks on Muslims, Latinos, and black leaders. Now a new NPR Ipsos poll finds big differences between the ways that people of different races view the same events. NPR's Adrian Florido has the details. Adrian, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What are some examples of these differences?
Well, a big takeaway in this poll that NPR conducted is that there are still big differences in people's attitudes about a lot of the racial issues that our country has been facing this summer, and that these divides largely are split along racial lines. So one example, fewer than half of white respondents to our poll said they support Black Lives Matter. That was a big takeaway. Mm-hmm. Only 30% of white Americans said they had personally done something to better understand issues of race after George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis in May. And those numbers were much higher for black and brown Americans.
What do those differences tell you?
So here's what Mallory Newell, the pollster who conducted the survey for us, for Ipso, the polling firm, this is what she said.
Our country at its core, there is still a significant gap in perceptions and willingness to do the work between white Americans and people of color.
You know, we've seen a lot of white people out at these marches this summer. There's no doubt that white Americans have been an important part of this movement. But again, what Newell said is that, you know, if we look at the country as a whole, this poll offers a bit of a reality check about who's engaging and who's not.
What kinds of attitudes did you find about defunding the police?
Well, the poll found there's a very big difference between how black, brown, and white people feel about this issue. Only a little more than a third of white people said they support defunding the police, while more than two-thirds of black people said they did, as did similar majorities of Latino and Asian Americans. One person who did not support defunding the police is Dee Weiler. She lives in Georgia.
I think that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. Who's going to respond when you're being held at gunpoint, if anything, funding for more training, helping them learn how to do things differently?
Interestingly, Steve, our poll also found that white Americans are much more likely to believe that after this summer, police will start to treat black people better. Almost 3/4 of white respondents said they believe that, but fewer than half of black people who responded to our poll said they believe that. Here is Jay Baptist, a black graduate student in Florida, talking about this divide.
They don't live in the type of environments that we do, so they don't see what we experience face to face. If they were to like just live in our little world and our bubble, then I really would think their eyes would be open.
And Steve, just looking at this shooting of Jacob Blake in Wisconsin this week, it's another reason many black people said they don't feel optimistic about their treatment at the hands of police going forward.
Okay, Adrian Florido with some poll results. Adrian, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
White girl, white girl, white girl. White girl, white girl, white girl, white girl, white girl.
I got that.
White girl, white girl, white girl, white girl, white girl. I
got the president is struggling to win over suburban women, or as he likes to put it, suburban housewives. And he has work to do. An NPR Marist PBS NewsHour poll this summer showed that 2/3 of women in suburbs and small cities plan to vote for Joe Biden. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben went to Milwaukee suburbs to see if the president's message is sinking in.
Ava Schultz doesn't feel like she can talk openly about her support for Donald Trump. She does talk about it with Joy Adams, though, her neighbor and friend of 37 years, and a Biden supporter. Sitting in Adams' backyard on a beautiful summer evening, the two women got into it once again.
Nowadays, if you say something, you're evil, and they go after you, and then destroy your property.
Do you think that he's brought up all the white supremacists?
Absolutely not. Really? Absolutely not.
So who are all those people that are... It's like
Schultz says Trump's messaging about the silent majority resonates with her.
I would never tell anybody that I'm going to vote for him. You know, I would never put anything on a car bumper or anything like that.
Adams, for her part, says she likes Biden more the more she learns about him. And either way, she couldn't possibly vote for Trump.
I'm afraid for our democracy. It scares me to put him in there for another 4 years.
All that said, she also knows that arguing won't do her a whole lot of good.
You're not going to change anybody's mind. You know, it is what it is.
Suburban women always get heavy attention in presidential elections, according to Kathleen Dolan, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin.
They used to be the soccer moms, and then they were the security moms. And, you know, those of us who study gender politics, it's like, okay, what are we going to call them this time?
Talking about suburban women is often a way of talking about college-educated white women, who have swung further toward Democrats in recent elections. It's also reductive, obscuring trends related to race and education, for example. But Dolan also points out that a few of the suburban counties around Milwaukee stand out demographically.
The suburbs in those counties are much, much more conservative, much wealthier. They're much whiter.
Lucetta Adams lives in the overwhelmingly white suburb of Hales Corners. Adams leans Democratic and, as a special education teacher, says she particularly trusts Biden on education. An incident from the 2016 campaign trail when Trump mocked a disabled reporter has stuck with her.
I don't know. I just think our kids have so much to give, and I am dedicated to that population, and I've worked with them for a very long time, and to see a president mock that is terrible.
This year, Trump is using fear to try to win suburban women's votes. That tactic is just driving Adams further away from him. She brought up a specific Trump Super PAC ad.
I get very angry every time it airs, and I haven't seen it air in a while. But it's the one where the mom and the child are hiding under a bed and calling 911 and someone's breaking in their house. And I think that is a terrible message.
Trump has in particular used the topic of affordable housing to reach white suburban women like Adams. This summer, he reversed a housing policy intended to fight racial housing segregation. His message is he's protecting suburbanites' home values, as well as their personal safety. Ashley Broadway, who is black, lives in the suburb of Brown Deer. To her, Trump's messaging is offensive, and she definitely won't be voting for him.
What makes that next person unsafe because they didn't purchase their house in that area? And why would you say that? I hate it in every aspect. It's incredibly racial, and it's just wrong.
For some women from further out areas, the feeling is different. Mary Ludwig is from Watertown, a small city between Milwaukee and Madison, and said she will definitely vote for Trump. But it's not because she's heard Trump's message that Biden would make suburbs less safe.
No, I haven't even really heard much about that.
Rather, she's voting for him because she opposes abortion rights, though she has mixed feelings about Trump otherwise.
He says things that he can be very offensive, and he talks before he thinks. But I personally think he's done great with the economy. He's an excellent businessman, and his kids are stellar. He has really great kids.
Suburban women have been the apparent targeted audience of this week's convention. Trump will make his direct appeal to voters in his speech tonight. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, Milwaukee.
Between a rock and a hard place, as the nation's two major political parties scramble for supremacy of this current political season, more is at stake than mere democracy. Black America faces inchoate choices, which are not as clear as initially presented. For Trump has been cast as the boogeyman, that ultimate threat to black life, a racist. Similarly, his nemesis, Biden, plays the role of apparent friend, especially given his former role of wingman to America's first black president, Obama. But Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage, and men and women are but players. When Biden was climbing the greasy pole of politics in the 90s, he sacrificed the future of thousands, tens of thousands of kids to his ambition by consigning them to adult prisons for life. Most of these kids were black and brown. For a man running on his empathy, it takes a cold dude to condemn children to an eternity in a prison cell. As such, wisdom advises that both claimants be regarded with caution. For both can be asked, do black lives really matter? Trump, long demonized in media, seems beyond the pale, and Biden's legislative background is little known except to journalists and scholars. Neither man really has a sterling history when it comes to black people. Indeed, quite the reverse. It is up to movement people to demand clarity and better policies for black people. What the Obama years taught many blacks is that hopes and emotions are not enough. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This summer, videos of black people killed by police officers have sparked outrage and a national movement for racial justice. 65 years ago, it was a photograph.
A photograph of 14-year-old Emmett Till lying in a casket. Till was visiting family in the Mississippi Delta when he was kidnapped, brutally beaten, and killed by white men after an accusation that he flirted with a white woman. Today, the story of another brazen killing in the Delta.
Just 3 months after Till's murder, in a neighboring town, a black gas station attendant was shot to death in broad daylight by a white man. Radio Diaries brings us the story of Clinton Melton.
My name is Dolores Melton Gresham. I'm the daughter of Clinton Melton and Beulah Melton.
My name is Dorsey White, Jr. I'm 86 years old. I am Beulah's nephew.
Growing up, the house that we lived in, it was like on a little bayou, like it was always a happy home. My mom, she was a beautiful woman. her nickname was Pretty Mama. This is what everybody called her.
Clinton Milton was what you call a good man. He worked hard, took care of his family. He was, you know, well-respected by all of the black people that knew him, and the white people that came in contact with him, they liked him also.
My dad worked at a service station. He pumped gas, fixed flats. We used to stand and wait for him to come home. And, you know, even though we couldn't tell time, we knew what time he's supposed to be coming home.
Glendora, Mississippi was a little small plantation town, just a little whistle stop on Highway 49. You know, at that time, you didn't have any protection as far as the law were concerned. It could just happen any time. You could be pulled over by highway patrolmen if you were driving a car and be abused. And a white person could, you know, start trouble and no one would interfere. I guess you felt like a rabbit in the forest, really, what you felt like. because you didn't have nobody to run to.
This is W.F. Minor, Times-Picayune, Jackson, Mississippi. The kidnapping of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old who disappeared on August 28th.
I was 20 years old when Emmett Till was killed. You know, it was the news of the day.
Two white men.
The kids at school would talk about Emmett Till and how they had thrown his body into the river. I remember being afraid to go to sleep at night because some white people might come in and do the same thing to my brothers.
The brutal lynching of Emmett Till demands prosecution of all persons for this heinous crime.
Emmett Till wasn't the only racially motivated murder that took place in the summer of 1955 in Mississippi. But Emmett was the perfect poster child. My name is Keith Beauchamp, and I made the documentary The Untold Story of Emmett Louis Till. After the Till murder trial, you have two men who was involved with the murder of Emmett Till, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam, and they are acquitted of all the charges by an all-white, all-male jury. And then they get to stand in front of the cameras and smoke cigars and so on. They would get off scot-free.
My name is Dave Tell, and I'm the author of Remembering Emmett Till. The acquittal fueled this environment, this sense that violence against black Americans would never be punished.
Something was bound to happen again. And 3 months later, just a few miles away, a 34-year-old gin operator drove to a gas station in Glendora, Mississippi.
On that day, Elmer Kimball was driving the car of his good friend, J.W. Milam, one of the confessed murderers of Emmett Till.
They were friends, you know. They would hang out together, the Kimballs and the Milams. I guess they'd be drinking beer. So it was late in the afternoon near closing time when Kimball parked the car near the gasoline pump. Clinton approached them, and they told him to put the gasoline in.
So my dad filled the car up with gas, and then when he had finished, he told me, that, you know, okay, you're finished. And he said, no, I didn't tell you to fill it up. I want $2 worth. And my dad told me, he said, I distinctly heard you say you wanted a fill-up.
That's when the dispute came. They said he didn't put the right amount in there. So he told him again, said, well, I put it in there what you told me.
He told my father, well, don't be here when I get back. And so when he told him that, the service station owner told my father, Clinton, just go home, you know.
Clinton started putting some fuel in his car so he could go home. And before he finished, they returned.
When he came back with the gun, he shot in the car. From what I was told, he had a bullet hole in his hand and a bullet through the head. I remember it was a rainy night, and we were actually in bed. My mother, she just came in, she was crying, and she was just came and hugged each one of us, you know, and told us that your dad won't be coming back home. I remember asking her why, And she said, "You got shot. Your dad is dead."
I'm Beulah Milton, the wife of Clinton Milton. I have suffered a great loss, the loss of my husband, from myself and my four kids.
The news cameras came now, and they had an interview with my mom.
We had great plans for Christmas. We had planned to get a tricycle for Vivian and a dining room set for Dolores.
That's her voice.
A basketball for Clinton Jr.
I like to hear her voice.
Now how will I make this test by myself without some help from somebody?
Megger Evers, who was a field secretary of the NAACP at that time, wanted to bring national awareness to the Clinton Milton case, but Beulah felt that it could be dangerous and they could receive backlash.
She had lost her husband and she had these four children. You know, she didn't have no one to really depend on. So I'm sure that, you know, she was heartbroken and I guess she was confused too.
So the trial was set for March 1956, but just before then, days before the trial happened, Beulah Milton was driving and her car ended up in the Black Bayou River.
She had her children in the car with her when she made a wrong turn and went out in the water.
My brother was 3 years old and I was five. We are in the car. The car is upside down. You know, you can feel the water just coming in. And my brother told me, he said, "Water getting in my face." And so I pulled him close up to me and I was feeling around because I was actually trying to open the door. But, you know, if you're upside down, everything is not in place. So I'm trying to feel the knob and I felt my mom, but she wouldn't answer me. We didn't know how to swim. I was scared that we were going to drown. Finally, I heard my uncle and this other man come along, and he got us out. And I remember them taking my mom out, and she wasn't moving.
Headline, widow drowns as trial opens. A widow who was set to attend the trial of a white man accused of gunning down her husband drowned under mysterious circumstances last week. Two of Miss Melton's children, Dolores and Clinton Jr., were rescued without serious injury.
I was told later that we had been forced off the road, but they never did say who or what. But they were thinking that it was because my mom was going to attend the trial and somebody didn't want her there. Was that accident or were we forced off of the road or what? I don't think nobody really investigated to see what actually happened to her. I would like to know.
When the Clinton-Melton trial began, it opened in the same courthouse where Till's murderers were tried just 5 or 6 months before. The same sheriff was on hand, the same lawyers were defending the defendants.
But maybe one of the most interesting connections was something that was not known at the time, that Elmer Kimball was an accomplice to the murder of Emmett Till. We now know Kimball was involved with both murders.
But in both cases, the juries ignored evidence and there was a unanimous verdict, not guilty.
How could they sit there and know that this man had killed another human being and they still find him not guilty? I really don't like to say this because God moved that from my heart, but I had in my mind at that time that every white person I saw, that I would just like to just shoot them, let them see what it felt like. After my mom and dad died, my aunt, she adopted all four of us, and she had three children at home. We often talked about that, what it would be like, you know, if our mom and dad was living. At times, I could actually picture the house where we lived in and everything that was in it. The bed, I remember the big heater that sat in the middle of the floor. In the kitchen table. I remember she had some red curtains at one of the windows. I remember that. At that age, you don't think you need these memories.
Dolores Melton Gresham, the daughter of Clinton and Beulah Melton. Today, Clinton Melton's name is engraved at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, honoring victims of lynching in the United States. This story was produced by Joe Richman of Radio Diaries with help from Sarah Kate Kramer and Nellie Gillis. It was edited by Deborah George and Ben Shapiro.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
Portland, Oregon has seen nightly protests for about 3 months, and police there have declared riots or unlawful assemblies about half of that time. But the laws governing that declaration are vague. And as Oregon Public Broadcasting's Jonathan Levinson reports, they have roots in the state's racist history.
On a Saturday night in mid-August, the 79th consecutive day of protests in Portland, a couple hundred demonstrators marched to the Penumbra Kelly Building, a building used by both the city police and county sheriffs. In addition to the marching and chanting, a couple of protesters also spray-painted the building and threw water bottles. Police said protesters also threw rocks. 3 hours in, moments later, a line of riot police rushed straight into a group of protesters. And for a few moments, police and protesters were engaged in hand-to-hand combat, with the police grabbing at the protesters' homemade shields and swinging their batons. Portland Police Bureau Deputy Chief Chris Davis recently explained how police officers come to a moment like that, how a protest in Portland becomes a riot.
A riot is when six or more people engage in tumultuous and violent conduct and thereby intentionally or recklessly create a grave risk of causing public alarm.
In the video posted on Twitter, Davis said before dispersing the crowd, officers provide warnings.
Ideally, those engaged in the event would follow the lawful orders given and peacefully leave, and no force would be necessary during a dispersal.
But that definition of a riot is subjective, and the dispersal inevitably affects hundreds of nonviolent protesters. On the first two nights of protests in May, police declared riots and used tear gas to disperse the crowds. But then, for nearly a month, they didn't declare a riot, but still used tear gas. So state lawmakers called an emergency session. They hoped to raise the bar by passing a law requiring a riot declaration before tear gas could be used. State Representative Janelle Bynum sponsored the bill.
We were hearing that people were getting caught in these tear gas deployments, and they felt like they didn't have any warning. They felt they were trapped.
It was signed into law on June 30th. That evening, police declared a riot for the first time in a month and blanketed a neighborhood in North Portland in tear gas. The police have since declared numerous riots.
What I didn't expect was for the bar to be so low.
And Bynum says the history of these laws is particularly relevant.
A lot of the riot and crowd control philosophy and statute was developed around the 60s and 70s, when protests around some of the very same things, rights for Black people, were taking place in the state and particularly in Portland.
On some nights, police have declared unlawful assemblies as soon as protests begin.
But then the riot part, who knows? Like half-empty water bottle or nothing, or like someone could walk on their property and like they declared a riot. It could be anything or nothing.
Folashade Ogunfeditemi says she's been protesting since the end of May because she says Black lives matter and policing is a fundamentally corrupt institution. She says the way the police are treating protesters amounts to excessive force, and she likens it to psychological warfare.
They're very finicky. They're very emotional. They show that in their actions. They don't care what they do.
And she says it's the police presence and their actions that are the real provocation. For NPR News, I'm Jonathan Levinson in Portland.
In rural Oregon, Black Lives Matter protests have sparked a backlash. Conflicts that began on social media have spilled onto a courthouse lawn. OPB's Emily Curitan reports.
Shortly after Minneapolis police killed George Floyd, Josie Stanfield organized a Black Lives Matter protest. The 28-year-old lives in Prineville, a Central Oregon town of about 10,000 residents. Fewer than 1% of them are Black.
So, like, the reason I did this was because I went to high school here, and I didn't have a good time in the community. I've always been targeted for being Black since high school. I've always been the Black kid that got targeted, specifically for being Black.
Stanfield remembers classmates throwing food at her and whispering the N-word in the hallways. A couple of weeks after the first Prineville protest, she met with the local police chief, Dale Cummins. It didn't go well. She posted a video about the meeting on Facebook.
We were repeatedly told that we are only 0.8% of the county. Basically, why are we making noise? Why are we asking them to do things when we're the only ones that care?
Chief Cummins responded with his own video on the department's official Facebook page.
Josie Stanfield made a video and, quite frankly, completely lied about the conversation.
Stanfield got a slew of threatening Facebook messages. One says, quote, "I promise I will run you over in my lifted Chevy." The conflict has now spread offline into weekly protests in front of the county courthouse. Distinct groups face off on either side of a highway. On one side of the road, people hold handmade cardboard signs supportive of Black Lives Matter, or Josie Stanfield specifically. Across the street, a crowd waves flags. American flags, pro-police flags, Trump 2020 flags, and the Confederate flag. One woman's t-shirt says, "Lying Josie has got to go."
Go home, commies, go home! Go home, commies, go home! Go home, commies.
On a recent Saturday, more than a dozen members of the 3% militia show up with assault rifles and zip-tie handcuffs. The paramilitary group aligns with conservative causes. Townspeople say they're here to protect Prineville from riots. Ken Clark and Brandy Gagnon sit behind a sign that reads, "Black Lives Matter is a racist movement. Prove me wrong." They say the conflict isn't about race.
It's 2020. Nobody cares about the color of your skin anymore. We really don't.
They're terrifying our children with every weekend of blasting off about something that doesn't matter.
The day is tense.
Back up! All of you, back up! Back up!
Violence is just narrowly avoided. In recent weeks, police have cited and arrested people after altercations. These heated confrontations are happening across the street from police headquarters. That Facebook video Prineville Police Chief Dale Cummins posted about activist Josie Stanfield, it was viewed more than 39,000 times.
You know, we're only a town of 10,000, but we have almost 18,000 followers on our Facebook page.
Cummins says he didn't violate any policies. After initially refusing to retract the video, it was removed after 10 weeks.
I get criticism, and that's just part of my job.
And have you ever called someone out on social media by name before who criticized you?
I have never had to.
Black Lives Matter activist Josie Stanfield says the consequences of the police chief's video go beyond unrest outside the courthouse.
I hide in my house. I hide in my backyard. I hide in my front yard. Cars drive by and I duck because I don't know who's going to see me and where I'm living.
She says she's lost some hope.
I've had so many people say we didn't have racism here until I started the protest.
She thinks real change would take a total overhaul of the town's leadership and a new police chief. Emily Curitan, OPB, Prineville.
When you're a cop, you're the torment free, the NCM Valley, then seize the Audi, then beam proudly, turn a routine traffic stop to your season finale. When you're a cop, you can shoot a motherfucker by the trailer park. Plenty evidence, sure defense, will be razor sharp, then turn around and taste a perp, for a blazing perp, I'm a cop.
If a police officer behaves badly enough, they can lose their certification to work in law enforcement ever again. That prevents problematic officers from bouncing from department to department. Mike Riker is an investigative reporter with the Seattle Times. He reviewed 4 years of data and found police are very rarely decertified in Washington state. In fact, no officer in the state has ever lost their certification for using excessive force. Mike Riker joins me now to talk about his reporting. Mike, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What made you start digging into the issue of decertification?
Well, I had some experience in Los Angeles previously reporting on police discipline, And so I wanted to know how officers were disciplined in Washington State. And I wanted to know how hard was it to revoke somebody's certification or to take away their badge and gun? And, you know, how often did that happen here? What are some of the obstacles?
So what does it take for an officer to be decertified in Washington State?
An officer can be decertified for any felony conviction, for lying to the State Criminal Justice Training Commission, which oversees certifications, and for misconduct. They have to be fired for one of four categories of misconduct. One is any crime involving dishonesty or false statements, so perjury. Another is drug crimes, any crime that would disqualify you from possessing a firearm. That's typically domestic abuse. And then there's a catch-all category called any crime committed under the color of authority. And an example of that would be a traffic cop pulling over somebody and demanding sex to get out of a ticket. Theoretically, excessive force would fit into that last category, but it is almost never pursued. In fact, in Washington, no officer has been decertified for excessive force.
How do we compare, Mike, with other states that have decertification processes?
Washington is not the most restrictive in the nation, and it's not the loosest. Here, you don't have to be convicted, but in some other states you do, which is actually a harder bar to meet for decertification. Here, one of the biggest issues is that you have to be fired for some of the misconduct.
So there are states where as soon as your superiors start looking into misconduct, they can also consider decertification. But here you have to wait until there's been a termination?
That's correct. And that's a big obstacle that we found. Sometimes officers appeal those terminations and they take years. And during that time, they're still certified. And we even found examples where that discipline's overturned. So they were referred for decertification, but because the officers are reinstated, the state cannot take action.
This happens at the state level. Can an officer who's been decertified in Vancouver, Washington, drive across the river and get a job in Portland, Oregon?
So there's this national index that keeps track of decertified officers, but there are a lot of holes in it. Not all states report to it. It's not required of states. Washington does report, but there's no law here that's mandating it.
So kind of a patchwork.
That's right.
Walk us through the data you looked at. How many officers might have been decertified in recent years versus how many actually were?
There are about 11,000 officers across the state, and each year, about 100 officers are fired from their agencies. And within that, about 40 are referred for decertification. So that means their police chief or their sheriff flagged their firing, their separation, and said, hey, state, I want you to review this officer and what they did, because I believe it qualifies to be decertified. So out of that 40 on average, just 10 a year are actually decertified.
Your story is full of examples of officers who people might be surprised to hear kept their certification despite behavior that got them disciplined or even fired. Give us one of those examples.
There's this officer, Nick Hogan, who was at Tukwila for a number of years and then later in Snoqualmie. Hogan had a series of excessive force incidents. He was accused of using a racial slur in one instance and pepper spraying a man who was pinned down to a hospital gurney with all four limbs. And that incident actually resulted in a federal indictment, which is really rare. You know, officers are almost never prosecuted for excessive force. He also slammed a man in Tukwila using this unsanctioned takedown and was disciplined for that. He was fired from both of those departments. And after all that, after the guilty plea, the state still let him keep his certification. Now, Officer Hogan, in his plea agreement, agreed not to be an officer for 15 years. So that's a that's an unusual circumstance, but he's technically still in good standing with the state, and after those years could come back.
So you looked at 4 years of data that will tell us how things have been, but we're at this moment now when protesters are putting immense pressure on politicians to increase accountability around police. What are the efforts to look at the decertification process? Are people focusing on this?
Yes, there's actually some movement afoot in the state. There's a retired judge named Ann Levinson. She's a former municipal court judge in Seattle, and also she's a former oversight official for the Seattle Police Department. And she's been working on this since about 2014, and she's proposed a number of reforms. And those have made it to State Senator Jamie Peterson, who is going to be circulating a bill, a draft bill, among stakeholders, and also State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who has been advocating for some reform. All of this on specifically decertification. You know, it's just, it's one component of a number of reforms that, like you said, are trying to hold officers to a higher degree of accountability.
We've been talking about this very specific procedural thing that happens with the police officer's employment. Why is it important for the general public to be paying attention to this?
It's important because police officers have the ability to take our life and liberty. They are given that authority by the government. And we as citizens have to hold them to the highest degree of accountability. And you're right, this sounds very wonky sometimes and very technical about what, you know, what qualifies, what doesn't qualify. But at the end of the day, if somebody has really violated the public trust multiple times and the average person can see on their face they're not suited to be a police officer, there should be a mechanism to take their badge and gun away. And it should be effective. It shouldn't have so many barriers and obstacles like we found.
Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ed. It was great to talk with you.
Just with all the attention in Wisconsin, and we talked about the horrors of living in that region for some time, do you think if you had stayed in Wisconsin, your situation would be the same, better, worse, and how would it be different? Just you saying, even in California, it's not like it's all roses. California has been slammed with the Rona, and they got the fires. I mentioned that before. You said working in the restaurant industry where they had to shut a lot of that stuff down. So do you think your situation would be better, the same, worse, if you had stayed in Wisconsin?
I think it would have been worse. And so part of the tragedy that brought me to California is that I was homeless in Wisconsin around my whole quote-unquote family. Okay, so if I had stayed in Wisconsin, I don't think that I would have gained employment. I think I would have still been unemployed. And I was homeless in California for about 30 days, you know, and with the weather being like it is, like I slept on beaches. At one point I was sleeping in the back of my job, ended up going to work. And, you know, in Wisconsin, man, you know what I'm saying? Like, I wouldn't have been able to do that. And then, like, I have to get used to people being so nice in California. Like, coming from that environment where I come from, man, like, the level of aggression that you have to carry is different, right? And then so, like, I term it as, like, getting used to the California lifestyle, like catching the vibe out here because it's very different. I honestly question if I would still be living and or what my mental health would be. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know where I would be if I stayed in Wisconsin.
Jacob Blake's life matters. That was the message today from the family and lawyers for the black man who was shot at least 7 times in the back by a Kenosha, Wisconsin police officer on Sunday. LaToya Dennis of member station WUWM was at the press conference where members of Jacob Blake's family spoke, and she joins us once again. Thanks for being here, LaToya.
Thanks for having me.
What's the latest information about Jacob Blake's condition in the hospital?
You know, today we finally found out more about his injuries. He has he was shot in the back, as we know, and he has a spinal cord injury. They said he had bullet holes in his stomach. Part of his colon was removed. His kidney, he has kidney and liver damage, and he was also shot in the arm. They say he's going to need, obviously, multiple surgeries in the future. In fact, he was rushed into surgery today. And with so many surgeries, they're concerned about bacterial meningitis.
Do Jacob justice on this level and examine your heart. We need healing.
Who was that that we just heard speaking there?
That was Jacob's mother. Her name is Julia. And she said that she's praying for not only Jacob, but she's praying for this country. She's praying for everyone that we do exactly what she said and re-examine our hearts.
Now, this widely shared video shows a police officer following Jacob Blake around the vehicle and shooting him in the back, but there's a lot we still don't know about the situation. What questions are people still asking today?
Yeah, what we don't know is, was Jacob armed? Some people have asked whether he had a knife or a gun. That's been floated out there. But we also don't know exactly what was happening before. Bystanders have said that Jacob was breaking up a verbal dispute between two women. Police were called. He walked around his car, tried to enter his vehicle, and then he was shot. There's rumors that he was tased before he was shot, but those are all unanswered questions still at this point.
There have been intense protests since the shooting, and Blake's mother called for an end to any violence. What are demonstrators telling you?
Demonstrators are saying that they do not plan to stop until police reform happens, until this officer is fired and until this officer is charged. And not only do they want to see him charged, they want to see him convicted, or not even just him, them, however many were involved.
Latoya Dennis of member station WUWM, thank you for covering this story for us.
Thank you.
Two people are dead after violence erupted in Kenosha, Wisconsin last night. A 17-year-old from Illinois has been arrested in connection with the deaths. The county sheriff says that self-styled militias with guns have been patrolling the streets since protests broke out over the police shooting of a black man on Sunday. That man's name is Jacob Blake. B. Ivory Lamar is a lawyer for Blake's family. And when I spoke with him earlier, I started by asking about Blake's condition.
Jacob's condition is still in critical condition, of course. He's had several operations. We are optimistic that, you know, he'll have some type of recovery in which he can have some type of enjoyment of life. The odds of him walking again is, is not very probable.
We've heard so little from Kenosha police about what happened. They claim that they were responding to a domestic dispute. But so far, I haven't heard that they've explained why officers opened fire. They haven't disclosed the race of the three officers or their identities. Can you tell us what you're asking for from the police department?
These are the challenges that we have, is that when you have police departments and you have bad apples, so to speak, you know, we want to be clear that we're not against police officers and law enforcement as a whole. It's just these bad apples. And when these type of circumstances happen, police departments tend to be very closed in and not very transparent with the families. So we're calling for the names of the officers to be released. We're calling for the termination of these officers. So we're asking for very swift action to be taken by the Kenosha Police Department, and the community and the family deserves that.
As we said, Mr. Blake is still getting care. He's still in critical condition. But in the meantime, Illinois police have arrested a young man responsible, they believe, for the death of two people during the protest in Kenosha. What's the reaction from the family to this?
You know, dealing with the first situation with Jacob is in itself unnerving. And in a protest, in a fight for equality, while citizens try to advocate and exercise their constitutional rights to do so and end up dead at the result of exercising those privileges, it brings America to a new low. You know, it's hard. It adds to the pain. You know, we respect the individuals and citizens' rights to stand up and exercise free speech, and they should not end up injured or killed as a result.
And the backdrop to this is the Wisconsin governor, Tony Evers, has supported the authorization of members of the National Guard to come to Kenosha to help law enforcement.
You know, I think that will probably hurt more than help the situation. The people, not only in a city of Kenosha or in the state of Wisconsin, they're calling for a dialogue. There needs to be some type of change. Then it happens from the top down. It happens from the chief of police in Kenosha County standing up and saying, these officers were, you know, rogue. They did not follow the standard operating procedures. This is not the way we train our officers. And as a result, you know, we're looking into taking disciplinary action as a result of that. That's the type of action that will calm these type of situations.
Jacob Blake was shot essentially in front of his children. What kind of condition are they in right now? How is the family coping?
You know, I thank you for asking that question. You know, in these situations, the children overwhelmingly have kind of been overlooked. You know, they were in the back seat of that vehicle. They experienced this firsthand, and they are having some real issues. I can tell you that they're going to need very substantial counseling and help to kind of deal with these things. You know, number one, from dealing with the emotional distress from what they personally seen, and then also from seeing their father, you know, the leader of their family. You know, Jacob was a family man. He was very involved in his children's life. In fact, as we know, on that Sunday, there was a birthday party for one of his sons, in which he was kind of orchestrating. And, you know, it's very painful.
B. Ivory Lamar, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
A 17-year-old has been charged with killing two protesters last night and wounding a third in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The shootings came during a third night of protests over the police shooting of a black man named Jacob Blake. LaToya Dennis of member station WUWM joins us now with an update. Hey, LaToya.
Hi.
So what can you tell us about this arrest? Who exactly was it and what were the charges?
Well, as you said, he is 17 years old. His name is Kyle Rittenhouse. He's a white male, and he was arrested in Antioch, Illinois, which is maybe about 15 miles away from Kenosha. He's been charged with first-degree intentional homicide, and basically extradition is pending at this point.
Okay, so what do we know so far about the victims of last night's shooting?
Not much has been released. Today we did find out their ages and where they live. So one of those who was killed was a 26-year-old who lived in Silver Lake, Illinois. Another was a 36-year-old right here from Kenosha, Wisconsin. And then the person that was seriously injured is another 26-year-old who lives just outside of Milwaukee.
Okay. Well, I understand that Kenosha officials have been pretty tight-lipped over the past few days, but the police did hold a press conference earlier today. I understand that you were there. What more information have they divulged?
You know, this press conference was really short on details. They did talk about how peaceful protests are allowed and they're accepting of those. But they said they don't really want more people out with guns and that violence will not be accepted on any side. Here is David Beth, who is the Kenosha County Sheriff, talking about an interesting call that he received.
I had a person call me and say, why don't you deputize citizens who have guns to come out and patrol the city of Kenosha? And what happened last night, and I think Chief McGinnis is going to talk about it, was probably the perfect reason why I wouldn't.
You know, Beth went on to talk about the fact that the county would be liable if, you know, something like what happened last night with an armed person shooting individuals if they had been deputized. And so he said he was glad that that didn't and that he would never do anything like that.
So I know that the city has been under curfew, which is now starting even earlier. What are you expecting in terms of law enforcement presence after these fatal shootings last night?
Yeah, I think we're expecting at this point, as you said, the curfew will be earlier instead of 8 p.m. It will now start at 7 p.m. And the purpose of that is to, they said, basically get people off the street in the daylight when it's easier to see. So I'm expecting that there will be more stricter, guidelines when it comes to actually getting people off the street. The curfew will be more heavily enforced. They have asked for more National Guard members to be sent here, and I believe Governor Tony Evers has agreed to send an additional 500. There are already federal agents here, and today President Trump said that he's willing to send more and that he will be sending more federal agents here. So that's to be expected as well. So it seems like more policing for sure.
That is LaToya Dennis of member station WUWM speaking with us from Kenosha, Wisconsin. Thank you, LaToya.
Thank you.
Law enforcement officials in Kenosha, Wisconsin have been mostly quiet since the police shooting of Jacob Blake on Sunday. But after two protesters were shot and a 17-year-old was arrested in connection with those killings, the chief of police, Daniel McGinnis, went in front of cameras and said this.
The curfew's in place to protect. Had persons not been out involved in violation of that, perhaps the situation that unfolded would not have happened.
Joining us now to talk about the Kenosha Police Chief is Gina Barton. She's a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And to correct something I said earlier, three people were shot. Two of them died from their wounds. I want to talk about what Ms. Guinness said after what we heard earlier about the suspect who's been arrested.
A 17-year-old individual from Antioch, Illinois, was involved in the use of firearms to resolve whatever conflict was in place. The result of it was two people are dead.
What's the reaction to this idea, the way the police chief is describing potentially the shooter as someone who was there to resolve conflict?
As you can imagine, the reaction has not been good here in Wisconsin. Today, the ACLU is calling for the police chief and the sheriff to resign. And people are really unhappy that he seems to be blaming the victims for being shot and turning an armed 17-year-old into some sort of hero.
He was also asked about the idea of armed groups, self-styled militias, patrolling the streets of Kenosha, and some videos of his officers allegedly offering them water, thanking them for coming out. How did the chief respond?
The chief did not want to get into that in terms of, he said he wasn't aware that that had happened. The sheriff, however, said the sheriff's deputies would give water to anyone, and people had called him and said, will you deputize citizens? And he said, oh, hell no, because this is the very kind of thing that can happen when you do that.
What has his tenure been like? I mean, what in terms of community relations?
The police chief became chief in 2016. Before that, he was a deputy chief. So he's been in law enforcement in Kenosha for 20 years. And during that time, the relationship between the police and the community in Kenosha has not been good. Black, white, Latino, other races, it just hasn't been good across the board.
And what's his response to things like a police reform or movements like Black Lives Matter?
This police chief is very law and order, very pro keeping the streets safe, and kind of has tended to blame community members for any disorder that happened.
What, if anything, has he said about the officers involved in the shooting of Jacob Blake and community response to how he's handling it?
He's said very little about the shooting of Jacob Blake, except to say that he's turned over that investigation to the State Department of Justice And therefore, he doesn't have very much information and can't really say very much about what happened. He's been very tight-lipped.
And the calls for him to resign, does he have a constituency of support? Or kind of what are analysts or, sorry, local watchers saying about how he's being viewed?
When he became chief, the Common Council debated for 7.5 hours before they came to a unanimous decision to appoint him chief. So he does have some support, but it's definitely not unanimous or overwhelming.
Is he expected to speak again anytime soon?
He has said he's going to have press conferences every day or nearly every day. So we'll have to see what he says tomorrow. But at the news conference today, he did not walk back the statements he made yesterday.
That's Gina Barton with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Pray!
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine.
Kenosha, Wisconsin was more peaceful last night following 3 nights of sometimes violent anti-police protests, including the Tuesday night shooting of 3 people, 2 of whom were killed. A 17-year-old named Kyle Rittenhouse has been arrested in connection with those shootings. He appears to have been a part of a self-styled militia roaming the streets of Kenosha that night. His arrest has highlighted worries about the presence of armed civilians at Black Lives Matter protests. NPR law enforcement correspondent Martin Costi has more.
When protests turned into rioting in Kenosha, local law enforcement was overwhelmed. But at a press conference yesterday, the sheriff, David Beth, says that did not mean he was looking for volunteers.
I had a person call me and say, "Why don't you deputize citizens who have guns to come out and patrol the city of Kenosha?" And I'm like, "Oh, hell no."
He said the shootings on Tuesday night demonstrated why he doesn't need civilians acting as his deputies. There is some video evidence that Kyle Rittenhouse may have been defending himself when he pulled the trigger, but the sheriff says the bigger problem is that the armed groups create confrontations. That's certainly what Tavion Williams thinks. He was there on Tuesday night, watching as the armed men purposely walked through crowds of protesters.
You know, the agitated person, they knew what they was doing. They knew the reaction they would get, and they got what they wanted.
He thinks the militia were there just to intimidate people. Nick Saplina agrees. He's with Every Town for Gun Safety, a gun control group, and he says this is part of a bigger culture shift.
It's not so much a particular change in law as a understanding in the country that, you know, if you want to be heard, you bring your AR-15 to the protest. And we think that the choice to bring an assault weapon to a protest is meant to chill First Amendment speech, not protect it or property or anything else.
But others say that ignores just how much serious harm has come out of recent protests, including assaults, arson, and the destruction of small businesses. Eugene Volokh is a libertarian-leaning legal scholar at UCLA, and he says if Americans want less policing, they should probably expect more armed civilians.
The historical argument for gun control has always been, oh, you don't need guns to protect yourself, the police will protect you. But if we're going to have less policing, whether in general or in these kinds of situations, then in that case, who is going to protect you if not you and your neighbors and your friends?
It's an attitude shared even by some who support Black Lives Matter. In the CHOP protest zone in Seattle in June, they had at least one volunteer who did security patrol with a long gun. And the simple fact is, in most states, the law now allows this. Former New Orleans Police Superintendent Ronald Surpass says over the course of his career, the move toward looser gun laws has meant that police have had to learn to coexist with armed civilians, even in tense settings.
If the statutes allow for people to have them and they don't violate the statute in any other way, then the police just have to be observational about the weapons present.
Still, there are some who believe the police could do more to discourage the people who want to play cop. They point to this cell phone video from Tuesday night in Kenosha. It's before the shootings. As the armed men walk down the street, law enforcement officers roll by in an armored vehicle, hand out some water, and then they have this friendly exchange.
We appreciate you guys. We really do.
Nick Saplina from Every Town for Gun Safety says that just sends the wrong message.
One thing law enforcement should do when they encounter armed militia is subject them to the same rules that they are enforcing against protesters. If there's a curfew and nobody is to be out, that goes for the armed men as well.
And Saplina says we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that these protests are about the police misusing their firearms. And he says if untrained civilians try to take the law into their own hands, it'll be even worse. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Mark and Patty McCloskey, we're speaking to you tonight from St. Louis, Missouri, where just weeks ago you may have seen us defending our home as a mob of protesters descended on our neighborhood.
America is such a great country that not only do you have the right to own a gun and use it to defend yourself, but thousands of Americans will offer you free advice on how to use it. At least that's what we experienced. What you saw happen to us could just as easily happen to any of you who are watching from quiet neighborhoods around our country. And that's what we want to speak to you about tonight.
That's exactly right. Whether it's the defunding of police, ending cash bail so criminals can be released back out on the streets the same day to riot again, or encouraging anarchy and chaos on our streets, it seems as if the Democrats no longer view the government's job as protecting honest citizens from criminals, but rather protecting criminals from honest citizens. Not a single person in the out-of-control mob you saw at our house was charged with a crime. But you know who was? We were. They've actually charged us with felonies for daring to defend our home. On top of that, consider this. The Marxist liberal activist leading the mob to our neighborhood stood outside our home with a bullhorn screaming, "You can't stop the revolution." Just weeks later, that same Marxist activist won the Democrat nomination to hold a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. In the city of St. Louis, that's the same as winning the general election. That Marxist revolutionary is now going to be the congresswoman from the 1st District of Missouri. These radicals are not content with marching in the streets. They want to walk the halls of Congress. They want to take over. They want power. This is Joe Biden's party. These are the people who will be in charge of your future and the future of your children.
They're not satisfied with spreading the chaos and violence into our communities. They want to abolish the suburbs altogether by ending single-family home zoning. This forest rezoning would bring crime, lawlessness, and low-quality apartments into now-thriving suburban neighborhoods. President Trump smartly ended this government overreach, but Joe Biden wants to bring it back. These are the policies that are coming to a neighborhood near you. So make no mistake, no matter where you live, your family will not be safe in the radical Democrats' America.
At this moment in history, if you stand up for yourself and for the values our country was founded on, the mob, spurred on by their allies in the media, will try to destroy you. You've seen us on your TV screens and Twitter feeds. You know that we're not the kind of people who back down. Thankfully, neither is Donald Trump. President Trump will defend the God-given right of every American to protect their homes and their families. But more than that, Trump's vision for America is a country where you have an opportunity to work hard and build the life you dream of, with a job you love, with your children being educated in great schools, in a community where your family can play in the backyard without fear, worship in a church without shame, and express your beliefs without retribution. Trump brought us the greatest economy our country had ever seen. The Democrats have brought us nothing but destruction.
When we don't have basic safety and security in our communities, we'll never be free to build a brighter future for ourselves, for our children, or for our country. That's what's at stake in this election, and that's why we must re-elect Donald Trump. God bless you, God bless the president,
and God bless these United States.
As far as the other situation, it's just so sad. What stands out to me is just watching the Republican convention, and they're spewing this fear, right? Like, all you hear is Donald Trump and all of them talking about fear. We're the ones getting killed. We're the ones getting shot. We're the ones that we're denied to live in certain communities. We've been hung. We've been shot. And all you do is keep hearing about fear. It's really so sad. Like, I should just be a coach. And it's so often reminded of my color. You know, it's just really sad. We got to do better. But we got to demand better. Like, we got, you know, it's funny. We protest and they send riot guards, right? They send people in riot outfits. They go to Michigan with guns and they're spitting on cops and nothing happens.
President Trump has accused America's professional basketball league, the NBA, of becoming a political organization after it postponed a second night of playoff games to mark the players' outrage at the shooting of a black man, Jacob Blake, by police. On Wednesday, the Milwaukee Bucks decided not to take to the court for their game against the Orlando Magic in protest. Baseball and football matches have also been called off. Mr. Trump's son-in-law and senior aide, Jared Kushner, had already criticised the move, saying that unlike millionaire sports stars, most Americans don't have the financial luxury of taking a night off from work. Now the president himself has entered the fray.
People are a little tired of the NBA, frankly, but I don't know too much about the protests. But I know their ratings have been very bad, and that's unfortunate. They've become like a political organization. And that's not a good thing. I don't think that's a good thing for sports or for the country.
I know you guys are able to have the big run at the fourth quarter, at the start of the fourth quarter, and pull this game out today, but you guys haven't seemed like you've quite gotten on the same page you were back in March so far in the bubble. What do you think has kind of prevented you guys from getting back in that same rhythm again?
I don't know. I don't think the world has gotten back in the same rhythm. So we're still having the injustice, social injustice and thing going on in the world. So, until the world get their together, I guess we're not going to get our stuff together. So watching the stuff that happened in Wisconsin, you know, the other day, really breaks my heart. You know, we're down here playing the bubble to do these things for social justice and all that. And to see it still going on, and we're just playing the games like it's nothing. It's just a really messed up situation right now.
Lori Nickel, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Hey, George, can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Oh. You have a knack for hitting the timely three-pointer. I wondered how you felt that Kyle and Wesley have blended into this team. They both kind of mentioned that's been, you know, part of their priority for a whole year, and I know you've had a long time, but how do you think they've blended in with you guys being in the bubble again?
I mean, I think they've done a great job, but, you know, I don't think we should even be talking about basketball today. We'll just talk about the Blake family and what's going on. It's, like I said, it's devastating, and basketball shouldn't even be on our mind right now. We're thankful for the win, but none of this really matters today.
Bontemps,
Along those lines, George, what went through your mind when you first heard about what happened and kind of, you know, I know you've talked about it a little bit here, but like what has kind of been your thought process over, you know, as you've had a chance to think about it?
It's just sickening. It's heartless. It's a fucked up situation. Like I said, you're supposed to look at the police to protect and serve. And now it's looked at harass or shoot. You know, to almost take a guy's life, you know, thank God that he's still alive. I know the cops is probably upset that he's still alive because I know they surely tried to kill him. But to almost take a man's life, especially in front of his kids that wasn't resisting and is back at point blank range is a heartless and gutless situation. And we need some justice for that.
Doris Stevenson, Bucks.com.
George, you've been active in all areas when it comes to issues of social injustice. Obviously, it's hurting you right now and it's affecting you. What do you feel like you or you all can do from Orlando, from the position that you're in right now?
I mean, we can't do anything. First of all, we shouldn't even came to this damn place, to be honest. I think coming here just took all the focal points off of what the issues are. But we're here, so it is what it is. You know, we can't do anything from right here, but I think definitely when this all settles, you know, some things need to be done. I think this world has to change. I think our police department has to change. Us as a society has to change. And right now we're not seeing any of that. You know, lives are being taken, you know, as we speak day in and day out, and there's no consequence or accountability for it. And that's what has to change.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, August 29, 2020. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. George Hill, my new favorite player. George Hill of the Milwaukee Bucks. Apropos. Bucking the system. That, even for additional context, they are in Orlando. That's where the so-called bubble is for the NBA playoffs. So they are in Orlando at Disney World at this elaborate multi-million dollar sports complex. You know, you hear what he said? Shouldn't have come to this damn place. They're in Disney World. Mickey Mouse is rolling over in his grave. But this is the NBA playoffs. The Bucks were victorious in their first round game over the Orlando Magic, no less, home team. And they're not running off. Oh, man, it was great. Knocked down a few threes, beat them down, get into the next round, get that championship, man. None of that. Game is irrelevant. We shouldn't even be talking about that. Talking about racism. Wow. Wow. Even heard that from Doc Rivers as well. That was the sound clip before we got to President Trump. Unfortunately, Doc Rivers, that would be a cowbell. But yeah. What a week. What a week. The number to dial is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Full week, many things to discuss. We'll try to get to the callers promptly and see what the heck has been going on the past 7 days. Folks have thoughts, suggestions to share. For one, invest if you think the cows is constructive. Visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. When you hit the blog, my PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're into Cash App, we are on Cash App, cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested for 11 and a half years. Hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy, particularly because Gus T will need a new computer sooner than later. That certainly could interrupt the cows if, you know, I have supercomputer issues, which could be the case, and end up not being able to broadcast. So I will definitely need a new MacBook Pro sooner than later. My wish list also on my blog, my Amazon wish list, where I do have a new MacBook Pro. It is listed under Gus T. Renegade at Amazon. Much obliged for all the folks who have nabbed items for 11 and a half years. Again, hopefully the context of white supremacy has been worthy of your time and energy, and help folks get a more accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is, how it works. Also, share the broadcast. Man, oh man, it seems like there might be a little bit more interest amongst victims of white supremacy. You can share on social media and such now, let folks know that we're broadcasting live, and then certainly share episodes, broadcasts. Folks say, hey, what is going on in Kenosha? Blake got shot, and Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, and blah, 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 and all this, and let's, racism, what is it? Why do these things keep happening? Context of white supremacy. Share the broadcast if you think it would help some non-white people get a little bit less confused, get a more accurate understanding of the problem we are trying to solve. Incidentally, I do also want to point out, so many folks are outraged about the police right now and that particular component. Just illustrating, I think I've said for years, and it's not that we haven't covered, you know, that component of white supremacy racism, norm stamper, nigger knocker and all. I'm just saying, I have said for years, I am not interested in these police shootings at all. I've said that. I've told folks, like, you don't need to send me all of the details. I've had people where they go, like, frame by frame and break down the shooting and what. I am not interested in any of that. I did not watch the Kenosha shooting and all of that. Like, the shootings, police shootings, are going to happen. They are a required component of white supremacy racism, and nothing can be done about that until the system has been replaced. That's the conclusion that I've come to. I haven't seen any evidence to the contrary. They can continue protesting that, like I said, you can just insert new name for next week. Probably be somebody shot before we even get done with this broadcast. That is the system of racism. That's even in sundown towns. Required component. You got to have that. Anyway, what a week it has been. I'm sure folks, many observations, lots to share. I will point out from the news segments, they talked about Clinton Melton. This was the black male who was killed a few days, literally, after Emmett Till, way back when, what is that, like 70 years ago, basically? And with that report, it reminded me, I normally say it, you know, for this broadcast exclusively, if we could not use metaphors, said that consistently, just being more mindful, aware of what words we use. Maybe a month ago, we had a discussion on the Global Sunday Talk, and we were talking about police shootings and the video. And June Allen, juneallen.net, in the UK, she's been a guest on the program many times. She was saying that she doesn't watch this footage. She doesn't recommend that black people watch it. It's harmful and doesn't allow us to be at our best selves in trying to solve this problem that just keeps seeing black people being butchered and killed, which I've agreed with that sentiment for years. And someone wrote in and they said that they didn't agree and that they think it's important to watch this footage. No problem. And I've said also for years, victims guaranteed qualified VGQ. If you think it's important, get that magnifying glass. I'm going to go frame by frame and break it down and get the HD version and boom, 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 screen. Okay, great. Do it. You'll have more footage to come. Just get ready because they're about to shoot somebody else. But this person wrote in and they said that they think it's important to watch the video footage, and they used the metaphor, they compared it to Emmett Till. And I said, pause right there. That is not an accurate comparison at all. The shootings that are happening right now, police shootings, to compare that to Emmett Till. Reason, well, let's examine. Why is that not an accurate comparison? Number one, Mamie Till Mobley, Emmett Till's mother, victim of racism, they tried to conceal what had happened to her child. They tried to rush through and let's just get him in the ground, you know, get on and done with this. She halted all of that. Wait a minute. Let's make sure that everyone is aware of what happened here. Butchering, castrating my child. Let's make sure that everyone is aware. We're not just going to rush this one in and try and participate in what they, using the metaphor, sweeping it under the rug. We're not going to do that. That is not the case with these police shootings circa 2020, anywhere in the last at least 15 years. And I mean, we may even go back further than that, but at least the last 15, 20 years, there is zero effort to conceal what they're doing. Michael Brown Jr., don't they say? 4 hours they left the body out in the street. That's not an effort to conceal. Eric Garner, how many different angles of video footage did they show? Out in broad daylight, in the middle of the street. How many angles of footage do they have with Philando Castile? Alton Sterling. Do I need to go? How long does the list need to be? Tamir Rice. How long does the list need to be? It's no effort to conceal. They're not trying to hide it. We stomp on black people all day long. Look at that. We got frame 855 with my knee in his groin. Look at that. Look at that. We got frame 851 with the dog chomping on. I mean, okay, so that's one. Number two, I think maybe till Mamie Till Mobley. This is speculation. I could be in error. But I think she would have probably thought differently about putting that photograph in Jet magazine of her butchered child if there were photos like that of children, black people, in every Jet magazine. That wasn't the case. You didn't see a child's photo like Emmett Till on the cover of Ebony, Jet, the rest of these publications every day. That is the case now. You can just wait. In fact, it's cliche. You even have folks, announcers and what have you, white people saying, wow, it seems like we have one of these shootings just about every month or so with the subsequent riot, just another black person shot. Like, it's not even news. Like, you have to have a riot and a few more people killed in the National Guard for it to even register. They had a shooting in Louisiana that nobody even talked about. This happens on a regular basis. It's many reasons. Emmett Till, victim of racism, the photograph, very important. That is not the same as what is happening now. In fact, Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, Top 10, and Cased, she wrote a piece in 2014. She talked about how the circulation of this footage is, she compared it to lynching photographs, but she said It's even worse or better, depending on your perspective, because this gets much greater circulation. You can go on and have memes of, you know, Eric Garner being choked out or whatever it is, and have that on Twitter and reach a million people. Like, they didn't do that with the postcards circa 1920 or even 1950s when Emmett Till and Clinton Melton were being lynched. But yeah, just examining the metaphor. And again, anybody, if you feel the need to watch all of the video footage of the police shootings or whatever else, go right ahead. VGQ, Victims Guarantee qualified. I do not engage in that activity and have explained why. Metaphors are very important, though. I encourage folks to examine, especially when we begin talking about white supremacy, racism, examine those metaphors. So frequently, they do not help reveal truth. They conceal, confound logic, help with deception a lot of times, because they will compare and contrast things that are not quite similar. Racists, they'll a lot of times they'll use these analogies and comparisons to spread confusion. Victims, myself included, we are still learning, so sometimes we just don't have logic to articulate our views, and so we'll insert a metaphor of some sort to share our thoughts, and a lot of times that just adds additional confusion. So if we could be direct, specific, exact with what we want to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. If we could take about 5 minutes to share our thoughts, observations, that would be grand. Just make sure that everyone gets at least one chance to speak. Also, if you could use your mute button, if you know you're in a noisy environment, just helps to keep out the audio disruptions, so we don't have to hear the television in the background, or if you're moving around or coughing or whatever else it is, just mute your line. And then when you're ready to speak again, you can unmute and share your thoughts. Share your 5 minutes, right? And then once everyone has spoken, if you have additional comments, you can rejoin and share again. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I think Dr. Ruby Lathan should be back with us soon. I'm very much looking forward to getting some of her thoughts. One on meal prep. Very excited to talk about doing some vegan meal prep for black people, Rona permitting, but also just getting some more tips on healthful eating and ways that we can be taking care of ourselves every time we put a fork, spoon, chopstick in our mouth. *61 if you have comments to share. Anything else I want to make sure? I guess one last thing I'll get in before we get to the callers. There was so much happening this week, so much chaos. They had a report on Breonna Taylor. This was on New York Public Radio. And victim of racism. We talked about that case down in Kentucky, and where they have been protesting and all that way before everything happened this week in Wisconsin. And they had this segment, and they had a victim of racism on, a professor, Dr. Alyssa Richardson. And basically they were saying that before Sandra Bland, black people said black people said that we can't go out and protest if something happens to a black female because of the police, because there's no video. So we can't go out and protest. But after Sandra Bland, that changed that narrative. She said, when Trayvon Martin happened, we mobilized. We didn't need video. We went out and mobilized because we have a narrative for black males. And I found it inaccurate. Ahistorical, it's the same old cliche, and it's, in my view, it's another sneaky component of black misandry, as though we're so concerned about black males that we go out and organize and rally behind a black male being killed by enforcement officers or some rogue watchman vigilante, when there are tons of black males who are killed and nobody says any. I think we just heard on the program yesterday that in workplace racism, that a coworker said, boy, I can't wait till he dies. Black male father of her child, and they're wishing death on him publicly. Not even withstanding that most black males, they are not going to go out and parade. I think we had a whole lot of hanging victims recently that people don't even know their names. Anyway, notwithstanding that that component is totally false, I looked at the other side and said, well, wait a minute. A whole lot of people went out and protested for Ayanna Stanley Jones. They didn't have video for her. A whole lot of people went out and protested for Tawana Brawley. Man, they wanted to kill Al Sharpton behind that one. They didn't have video for Tawana Brawley. Death to Al Sharpton, they said. A whole lot of people went out and protested for Joan Little, 1975, way back. We talked about that with Danielle McGuire, Racist Suspect, her book, At the Dark End of the Street. Joan Little, she killed a police officer with an ice pick who tried to rape her. Talk about black self-respect. But a whole lot of people, white and non-white, came out to protest and support Joan Little. They didn't have any video there. So it's just, it's absurd. Renisha McBride, I had a long list of us. Totally inaccurate to just push some narrative that, oh, we just care about black males and we don't care about black females. And we didn't. False all the way around, ahistorical, and that sneaky black misandry. I saw that report this week, and there was a lot of that this week, even in the midst of everything that happened in Wisconsin. System of racism, white supremacy. Yes, the black male privilege. If you are killed by the police, there will be mandatory outrage and hashtags and activism. Yes, 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 yes. Anywho, *61, if folks have commentary you would like to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, yes, sir.
And speaking of the sharing economy, Uber and Lyft say they might.
Hello? Oh, yes, we can hear you. Sorry about that. I think I was muted. Sorry.
Oh, was there a female caller that wanted to go before me?
Was there? Was there a female caller? I know the other one was a female caller.
Okay. If not, I'll just go ahead.
Right on.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The report that you just that you said you read a couple of minutes ago, that was typical of black misandry. You know, the thing about black men, and you know, you've had Dr. Tommy Curry many times as he talks about, you know, black males, you know, there is no humanity within black males. I mean, at least with, you know, black females, you know, they can at least, you know, hedge their humanity through, you know, womanism, and even with black males through homosexuality, their homosexuality is, you know, rooted in humanity. But basically black males are kind of, you know, the animals of the human group. And, you know, it's interesting how, you know, we get there's support for black males when they die. But, you know, there's no support for black males while they're living, or, you know, support for black males to sustain a, you know, a normal life. So that's pretty interesting. The clip on the two white gun owners in St. Louis, the ones that were in the Republican National Convention talking about basically doing what white people typically do is, you know, play the victim role, and, you know, how they're, you know, being attacked by these revolutionaries was just, you know, typical white people trying to play the victim. And I think that it was very apropos to play Doc Rivers' speech as you know, he asked the question, you know, how are these white people afraid? And, you know, black people getting shot every day and getting killed every day. So, you know, I thought that was very apropos. Doc Rivers, who is a victim, but, you know, I think he said a lot in regards to what the system of racism, you know, does to non-white black people in this country. the white young terrorist, Kyle Rittenhouser, who went to who lives in Antioch, Illinois, who drove all the way to Kenosha, Wisconsin, who was driven by his mother to Kenosha during that time, and then picked up by his mother after he done shot, you know, two or three people. So
the NBA Finals opened last night. Of course, for years this was.
Hello? Can I still be heard? Oh, okay. Well, I will continue. It was so interesting. The local media here, when they first reported this young terrorist shooting these people, he was actually called a juvenile. And then they went into his history about how he was bullied in school and basically kind of given the benefit of the doubt. So, you know, you can imagine if that was a black 17-year-old holding an AR-15 in the crowd, you know, what would have actually happened to him and how they would have probably, you know, talked about how he's so violent and how, he's doing this and doing that. And probably would have charged his mother because I still don't understand why they haven't charged her for being an accessory to this crime. So that was an interesting scenario as well. So one more thing. I remember the two gun people in St. Louis who spoke at the Republican convention, how they talked about how the Democratic Party is Joe Biden's party, and Trump like had his whole family speaking at the Republican National Convention. So that was very ironic too. But you know, obviously, white people lie. So that's all I have on my line.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. My apologies for the brief audio interruption. I lost my composure. I was cracking up laughing. I did not know that the white suspected killer in Wisconsin, that this 17-year-old, he was so gangster that he didn't get an Uber or a Lyft from the scene of the crime. He got his mom, like, I lost my composure. My hand slipped. I lost my composure. It took me a while to kind of get things together. But, wow. I guess that's what you do. I did the same thing when I was a child, a teenager. Get mom to get your – woo, man. System of white supremacy. Amazing. Absolutely she should be – like, you know, you picked up a little killer like you didn't charge to. You're an accessory to all this. Wow. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hello.
Greetings, Irie.
Hi, Gus. Excuse me. Hello, everyone. I hope that everybody's doing well. Just a few things. You were mentioning the Black Miss Andry, and, I really feel that I know it's a lot of black women and so-called trans women that are saying that black men have privilege and that black men are the only people being, focused on with police misconduct and injustice, but it is true. To a degree in the mainstream media, absolutely, and they need that. They have to rely on that because the monster at the end of the day that they, or the people they perpetrate to be the monster truly, are black men. But what I find to be more true is that there's a division in the gender among non-white black people when it comes to the showcasing of black women right now, as far as the sexual confusion that they are using black women to promote, and also the showcasing, the racial showcasing confusion. They're using black women, victims of racism, to in ways that are improper, incorrect. You know, for instance, I was with a friend and I had to explain to her about racial showcasing confusion that they were using with the Democratic convention with Cardi B, and she couldn't understand it. I said, well, let's look at it. Here we are. We have a situation where 1 week this victim of racism comes out with probably the most incorrect video and song I've ever heard. And then the following week she's being interviewed by Joe Biden. I said, what does this lady have in common with you other than being a non-white female? You're not rich. She doesn't go through what you go through. Why is he talking to her? Why isn't he talking to a working black woman or a black male or a black child, for that fact? And then, you know, I just feel like black women are misconstruing the ability to be showcased improperly and incorrectly as empowerment. And it's just the furthest thing from the truth. And they really rely and need black men and women to be disconnected from each other in order to, you know, find new pathways for the system. I'm sorry, that's a metaphor, but find new mechanisms for this system to keep going. So I would ask black women to be aware of that. And I think, too, that black women have been misconstruing black male privilege with the hypersexualization that black men have been allowed to behave in. It's not black male privilege to see a black man, you know, going around with different women or behaving incorrectly in a way that's allowed, you know, in the media. That's not privilege. That's victimization. I heard a non-white black male say on an Instagram post that the reason why the people want the police defunded is because the police work for the people. And I advise that non-white people study the origins of modern American law and European law, a.k.a., you know, that maritime law. And when you do, you'll understand the police wasn't established to work for the people. It's established by the corporation, which was established by white supremacists. They called themselves landlords back in the day, and now they call themselves whatever municipality you happen to fall under. So, no, they don't, in fact, work for us. They work for the white supremacists, and that is why they're doing what they're doing. And that is why defunding the police, you know, in my opinion, is just going to lead to them saying, okay, you don't want the police? Fine. It's everybody for themselves, and then they'll institute some type of purge-like situation in which outright slaughter and maiming and whatever else is condoned for a certain amount of time, and then they're going to blame black people for that by saying you all didn't want the police and you got it. So we really need to be careful about the words we're saying and the things that we're asking for. I don't hear anybody really coming out with a point-by-point plan on reform fully. You know, I have heard of, like, the bail reforms, which is, that's true. That does need to change. But in order to change the police, you have to change the system, or you have to abolish the system. That's the point, period. And I also, this is my last point, I also see a lot of non-white people getting stuck on nuances that do not offer improvement in our lives and frankly are irrelevant in a way. So there were some people on YouTube going back and forth about, like I said, I watch things on Kemet and I also read up on it too, but there's a guy that, a victim of racism black guy that kind of trolls other people that want to expatriate, and he trolls people that are looking into our history in antiquity. And he's telling people that there was no slave trade because there are no slave ships that can be found. And I had a conversation with a classmate of mine that does deep archival research and everything, and she told me how you can basically prove, even though there are no slave ships, that there was a slave trade, etc. You know, but there are people that are so, they're going out of their way to, I guess, mask the shame and the whatever of, you know, that they're feeling of white supremacy, that they're going around telling people there was no slave trade and that we were here already, and that the enslaved people are basically Native, we're the Native Americans. And it's my opinion, but I think that's wrong. But the point is, that's not helping anybody right now. We need to, if anything, focus on getting rid of the problem. Then we can sit down and have these red table talks and TED talks and any other talks about who we were before we were captivated. But let's figure out a way to get free first. Let's figure out a way to end white supremacy and replace it with justice. Stop looking to entertainers for a revolution and your education. And minimize contact and, you know, stay safe. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Minimize contact. That is always a good one. Wowee. We do get distracted. Distracted on lots of things that move away from solving the problem. Absolutely. Just be very mindful of that. Very, very mindful of that. Like, even if this is the case, what is this going to do to solve our problems right now? That's the way that we want to be thinking. We do not have time to waste on distractions, and it is always great to remember the folks causing the problem are all classified as white. Very important that we do not get distracted with the examples of racial showcasing either. They are victims of racism. They are not the folks causing the problem. Other folks that we've missed totally. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
This is Mo from Dallas. Greetings, callers and listeners. Thank you for the program again. I have a few pages of notes. So I'm gonna expound on a couple of. I work backwards actually. And I'll cut myself off so I don't take up too much time. Now the comment about black males reminded me of a quote from actually book club, you know, White Dog, Romaine Gary. I believe it was in chapter 22 or 23, I forget, but it was love for the beast and hates his beastliness. That's the kind of situation black males find themselves in, you know, because in one instance, you know, our women or female victims of racism or, you know, other people you know, perpetuators of racism, praise the black male for his abilities. At the same time, if, you know, something happens to the black male, it's, you know, well, did he have a knife? Did he not have a knife? You know, it's always some sort of rationalization for black male pain. I find it interesting, you know, and like it's a lose-lose situation. The police chief in Kenosha, I thought it was interesting that he received his position in 2016. You know, that was the year of Trump. And he's very serious about his stance, you know, kind of like Trump. And I think, you know, this his constituents, you know, kind of promote that sort of mentality. No officers in Washington have been decertified for excessive force. And I've deduced that excessive force is acceptable behavior. That's why they haven't been decertified for it. I think that's kind of what they prefer. This is why they can gain employment in other counties and whatnot. I had no clue that the individual that participated in the murder of Emmett Till also murdered a man, Clinton Melton. And if you ask me, I think it sounds like, when I was hearing the article, it sounds like he had something to do with the murder of Beulah Melton, just from the way that the article, or the, you know, the, yeah, the article was speaking about. And Mississippi Native says he feels like a rabbit in a forest. I would like to say to that, you know, Emmett Till, that situation happened in 1955. It's 65 years later, and I don't think, you know, not much has changed. I think, you know, if you are aware of the system of racism, you feel like it, just that, you know, a rabbit in the forest. One of the other segments of non-black suspected white supremacist said that Donald Trump has stellar children. I thought that was very interesting, seeing that his son had the word cocaine trending, you know, for his appearance in the RNC. But, you know, Hunter Biden also enjoys cocaine, so I think that Trump and Biden are evenly matched, if you ask me. They have, like, Biden may be more refined, but I feel like they are evenly matched. With that being said, Republicans switching sides, you know, the Republicans against Trump, I think they just believe he's off code. They say that his tweets and his rhetoric is, you know, unacceptable, but I would like for it to be, you know, known that his tweets and rhetoric have remained constant throughout his presidency, you know, so he's very consistent. And I think that consistency is what makes people uncomfortable, or they could just be, you know, saying what they want to say in front of the cameras. And, you know, there are no cameras in the voting booth. They have lines now, but no cameras. One of the ladies that was participating, she said, Trump supports religious freedom and religious rights. And I assume that she was talking about white supremacy, because I don't hear Trump talking about religion much, but I do hear a lot of white supremacist rhetoric. A Kanye West quote that was in between segments, he said, "Stop focusing on racism." I thought that was funny, just because he could be facing criminal charges for not filing campaign finance forms with the Federal Election Commission. Even though he announced his campaign in July, and you're supposed to submit forms every month. It's only August, you know, 1 month later, and they're talking about criminalizing him for being delinquent in his files. So I thought that was interesting. So I just wonder if he's going to not focus on racism. Well, that's all for now. I have a few more, but I mute my line on that point.
Black male privilege, Kanye West. FOMO years, either way. Don't think Kanye is going to impact what happens in November. I could be wrong. Other folks, much obliged. Mo in Dallas, Roman Carey, White Dog. Man, oh, man. Gaming Whitey, I'm hoping he gives us more details maybe so we can get skills on that before we wrap things up. It has been a fascinating read. Roman Carey, White Dog. Other folks that we've missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Rob, formerly in Wisconsin. Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone.
I wanted to highlight the young white male that drove down and killed the protesters. You hear so many people talk about, like, the young generations of white people aren't racist. And I think that this proves otherwise. Like, I went to prison at 18 years old. And at 18 years old, even though I was going through adult things, I was still a child. And at 17, I was even more of a child. So we got this 17-year-old child that gets driven by his mom to a different state to enact violence on black people. And my question would be, at what age did he start forming these views of black people? And then the second thing I would like to highlight is just like listening to the clip that you replayed back of, you know, what I was going through while I was in Wisconsin. It was hard to listen to because a lot of times, most of this time that I've been on this journey, I haven't had time to stop. You know, it's just a constant movement, you know. And so, like, hearing what I went through, it's like, wow. Thank you. Thank all the well wishes and everybody that's, you know, just been wishing me well on this journey. And thank you for taking the call. Context of white supremacy. Much obliged, Rob, formerly in Wisconsin. Thankful to be out of there. Man, I was at the White Privilege Conference I think it was the 10th one, but it was in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And I cannot say that I was in love with Wisconsin during my stay there. I was rather glad it was brief and not too cold while we were there, but no place that if I had to trade Wisconsin for Seattle, like, oh man, woof. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks that we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, comments, observations, questions to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I heard several folks. Do we have a female, or it sounded like it might have been several. Was it at least one female caller?
I'm one.
Let's proceed.
Okay, I won't be long. I just wanted to comment on just the collective that you did of the week, and the tone in the articles. In defense of the white people, like I was listening to the lady talk about the Black Lives Matter, I guess it was Black Lives Matter protest, Caucasian lady. I guess she was being interviewed and she was just saying how it didn't need to be there. They, you know, like they're killing their kids, and how now Wisconsin is calling in for the military to come in, or National Guard or something like that, someone else, another force to come in and police the city, and then making it like, okay, so since whatever's going on with you black people again, and you guys kill yourself and do all this other stuff, the way they set it up to pretty soon no one will have empathy for us, because they're going to turn it into every time something happens to us by non-black people, we turn it into this big protest riot, and now people are getting killed, and now white people are just going out just hurting people, and you're going to get our kids killed. And I'm just listening to the tone of every segment that you play and how they're connecting it or gearing the pieces towards their next move. And I think a lot of it is to militarize particularly us first, and then everyone else will kind of get in line. It just seems real weird, just the setups. And they said that the guy we're talking about that's in the hospital, the Wisconsin victim, now he's hospitalized with handcuffs. So just the things that they put out there to generate conversation, to have them go out there so they can, oh, they're tearing up every time something happens. They're tearing up the place. They need to be contained. So thank you for taking my call, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Bay Area mom. That's, you know, pay attention. You can just pay attention to the tone patterns in the news segments. That's what I do. That's what I encourage other folks to do. 4 more years. Before we met, was there another female caller? Just making sure we didn't, because I thought I heard multiple folks. So if there was not another female caller, all right, male caller, not sure who that was, but thank you for yielding. Feel free, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Yeah, a very interesting week to go with, along with a very interesting 2020. Good to hear from Robin, Wisconsin, California. NPR, CIA Radio, Voices of America, Free Radio Europe, Radio Liberty, definitely going to be spewing anti-Trump propaganda till the election. I guess their angle is Trump's a racist. Even the little, I guess she's black, female, she's not from here, but who questions someone at the White House, he's even, every question is thrown about, like, he's the only racist white person in the world. The NBA should have never come back. Protests were going on, coronavirus. Several players didn't want to distract from the protest, and they were attacked by other players, including the media, ESPN analysts and Fox and all those places. The ratings are so low with all this social justice messaging and the commercials, jerseys, and on the court. They're getting less ratings than Fox News and Primetime. That's Hannity, Tucker, and Laura Ingraham. They're outperforming the NBA Plus, MSNBC, and CNN in ratings. So it's just showing where white people are focused. Definitely not on these protests. The players deciding to sit out the NBA playoffs, I thought, was a codified response. I respected Kenny Smith from walking off the set. I didn't like the decision to come back. Why are you coming back? You decide not to play, you should have just packed up your stuff. Apparently, the NBA owners sent their fellow owner, Michael Jordan and Barack Obama, to convince the players to get back on the court. For some reason, the NBA players like LeBron and many of them are confused victims. They don't understand that they're pushing, first thing is they're blaming all racism, white supremacy, including these police shootings and things, on Donald Trump. Like, we didn't have the same thing under Barack Obama and every other president that's been in this country. And that's not taking a social justice stance. That's taking a political stance. They're politicizing things, and that's where they're messing up at. The radio dispatch to the call, I got a chance to listen to it. It seemed like it was authentic, although it was not in the mainstream media. But it's appeared that the police were responding to a domestic violence call, male and female. The male was the aggressor. The male had taken and refused to give back the property to the female, which was either keys or a phone. And they said his name was Jacob Blake Mill, with an outstanding warrant. So therefore, the cops were going there to detain him, if that's true. When the police come to detain you with a warrant, they don't need justification. And they definitely didn't hear in that call. It was about two females fighting. The young man was shot in the back. That was difficult to watch. Reminded me of Walter Scott. The police official word, and I'm sure they'll have footage of this in some way, is that he fought the officers, resisted arrest, had a knife, walked away from the cops, and opened the door. If the police had a warrant, once again, I mean, what did they do wrong? This is like the guy in the Atlanta parking lot, wrestle the cops to the ground, take their taser, shoot the taser at the cops, and they shoot him, and that's wrong for the cops to do it? Like, what do you want them to do? The protesters who got shot, they were burning cars and damaging property. I saw the shooting of that, too. The white man ran after them with an assault rifle and shot one in the head and ran away from the scene. And people without guns go running after him, trying to punch him and knock him down. You can know these are white people. And then he turns around and shoots them after he gets knocked down. Well, what did you think? You were going to punch a bullet? Even those two white people who I saw on the Republican thing, protesters, these have not been peaceful protests that I've seen. I've seen white people looting, throwing bottles and bricks at police, setting fires, throwing fireworks in buildings with police in the building. I mean, unbelievable. And as the media keeps saying, these were peaceful protests. Rest in peace to Chadwick Boseman and Cliff Robinson, two very young black males with money. Area 8, very deadly. I watched the documentary on Yousef Hawkins on HBO, started by a white female. Kind of reminded me of the premise of the series Godfather of Harlem, where Forrest Whitaker plays Bumpy Johnson, same storyline. I was in grammar school when this happened, so this brought back a lot of memories. Young Al with the big belly and the big perm. Young Farrakhan, young Jesse, young David Dinkins. David Dinkins became mayor partly because of this whole thing. The shooter served 30 years out of 32 years when this film was released. So I think he only has one more year to do before he comes home. But what made me watch this was because in New York we have the radio station called Hot 97, which was, at one time it was the biggest hip-hop and R&B station in the country, probably the world. And they had a host named Angie Martinez, whose executive producer's name was Patty Duke. And during the course of the show, she always say, "Patty, play the music," or something like that. And he'll play it. And his real name is Pasquale Rossi. He was fired for being convicted of being a member of the mob that beat Yousef Hawkins to death after, of course, they shot him four times. Spent decades on Hot 97 around black people in black radio, making all this money. And it turns out that he was a part of that mob all this time. How didn't they know? But Yousef Hawkins, Emmett Till, Trayvon, Ahmaud Arbery, all victims of white supremacist vigilantism. That's what we're seeing. And it's been consistent, just like white supremacist policing.
been consistent. It's not one person behind it. It's time to go at white people in general, not just blame everything on the latest white person they want to blame everything on, the obfuscate everyone else's actions in creating the situation with it. It's ridiculous. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Josh.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. The journalist that you are referencing, I guess, who asks questions of Donald Trump, is that Yamiche Alcindor? Is that who you're talking about? Not hearing you if you muted yourself, Thomas in New York.
I'm not sure her name.
Oh, okay. Yamiche Alcindor is a black female journalist, and she regularly is the one. I mean, there's not a whole lot of black females, not a whole lot of black people, period, in the press row at the White House. So if I had to wager, I'd feel pretty confident, but I might be wrong. But I suspect it's Yamiche Alcindor is who you're referencing. She was born in Florida. I checked while we were going. I thought she was, I mean, if that means anything to anybody, but she's definitely would be classified as not white. I think she's a black female, and it says she was born in Florida. Let's see. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we missed totally. If you would like to join in, I knew the NBA ratings were bad before the Rona. They had been talking, and this has been like the worst season ever for NBA basketball. Like, they started, they had the big controversy because I think the white owner of the Houston Rockets said something about China. Oh, he said something about Hong Kong. He said something sticking up for them, and, you know, they're supposed to be free. And so the people in China were furious. And so that's a huge, I mean, you got lots and lots, billion non-white people over there. So they canceled games and said they were going to boycott and all this. And that started things off. Then Kobe Bryant died and all the rest of it, the Rona stuff. I mean, terrible year. And now, the Negroes are being uppity and George Hill and the rest of them and Doc Rivers' cowbell is, worst season ever. So I didn't know about their ratings doing all this, but I suspected. I cannot imagine people going to watch basketball in the midst of all of this, like, and especially if it's going to be Negroes, you know, protesting and sounding like George Hill every day. Like, not watching that at all. Folks that we missed totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out about the protests. Like, as soon as the courthouse closed on Friday, the whole University Avenue, couple of blocks down from the courthouse, a whole bunch of people marched from University of Florida to the downtown courthouse, and I guess they were having a bunch of speakers, and I just heard this the same message about so-called unity and being peaceful, and I just, in my opinion, I just didn't sense anything constructive. Like, I seen more and more white people holding up signs, saying usual like symbolism and slogans, but I'm not seeing any. I don't know. Like, it just seemed like it's just the same old recycled strategy, I guess. And it just had me thinking, where in a lot of these other cities and states, where you have a lot of destruction of property and it's something that's easily focused on by the media, where it's like, oh my goodness, you got all these riots going on and People are tearing things up. Look at this. And then all they have to do is put Black Lives Matter on it. Like a white person can go spray Black Lives Matter on something. Like I just seen it just last week. It was a concrete wall, and it said Black Lives Matter, reform the police. Now, I can easily see some white people doing that because nobody was saying reform, or not reform, but defund the police. And they had a back and forth on a larger highway where they were saying Blue Lives Matter. And then it's tacky. And then they had somebody come around and then paint over it and say Black Lives Matter. And then a white person comes over and say Blue Lives Matter. Like, they actually had this going on, the slogans. And then there was one where they had a bunch of white people said pedophile lives don't matter. Just white people practicing racism and promoting confusion. And one last thing, there was the governor a few weeks ago. He was at Florida State University, and I guess they were talking about the season starter in college football and practice racism, in my opinion, where him and the coach for FSU, he was like, oh, how can you deprive these young people of playing football? And they will actually be safer here than outside of here. So I'm like, are you serious? Like, brain damage, all kinds of injuries they could be subjected to, and possibly catching COVID with all of the intense physical contact. And he said that they're safer here on the field than anywhere else. So clearly a racist comment. And I believe the University of Alabama has gotten over 1,200 cases of COVID after a few days of starting classes. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
1,200 cases? Is that what you said?
Yes, sir. At first, I read this week it was 500 students that tested positive, and then a few days later, it was reported that it's 1,200, yes, sir.
Wow. Now, I saw UNC was one university that I was paying attention to, North Carolina. Scotty Reed. And they were going ahead with classes, and they kept having outbreaks like that, and it just kept going up and kept going up, and the student paper, white people there upset, taking it serious, and they ended up shutting things down after about a week. I forgot my name, but it was probably something in the same, in terms of the number of cases, was probably similar. But I had not heard University of Alabama, I mean, 1,200. August isn't even over. I mean, it's not like they started class at the beginning of the month, I don't think. It's probably been like a couple days, maybe. Wow. Not to be lost on all of that, the college football comment about it being safer. Now, with all of the, you know, criminal activity in the ghetto, looting and such, so, you know, we might be doing them a favor, you know, a little brain damage, a little Rona. You could be carjacking, stealing rims. I mean, not an equal trade-off. 6 in 1 half, half dozen in the other. About the same. Well, that's your black male. There you go. Division 1A sports program, Power 5 conference. Go, what is it? Roll Tide. That's what they say. Roll Tide. Roll Tide. Alabama. Other folks who we have missed totally, do not wait till the last minute. I was going to make sure I got into. I think it's, what is it, Kyle Rittenhour? That's how you say it? Kyle Rittenhour, the suspected killer who got a ride from his mother in Wisconsin, doesn't even live in Wisconsin. I think he killed 2 white people. I don't think he killed 2 black people. I could be wrong, but I saw photographs. Like, they named them. If other people saw, you know, you can I don't do all that. I got to look every shooting of a Negro. I do not feel obligated to go and look at all the information. I've already given my conclusion about all that. But I did see the images, and I've been fooled. I make errors sometimes, but I think he shot two white people and was two. Yeah. He killed two white people in Wisconsin. Anybody seen where they can,
yeah,
he killed
two white people and shot another one in the arm. I could send you, it's white on white crime, so I could send you the video of it. But yeah, that's what he did. I was very intrigued that it was white people. At first, I thought it was black people. And then I looked, I said, oh, these are white people. So I immediately sent it to the firefighter, like, oh, we get white on white crime. You know, but yeah, as you're right, it was the Alcinda lady, and she born from two Haitian parents. Yes.
Okay. Does that mean anything? I don't know what that means. At any rate, I thought he killed two white people. Well, I get to the white person just because that is always the problem. That is more important. I thought he killed two white people. I thought we had at least had one person. It sounded like there might have been some confusion. He thought he killed some black people. And, in fact, they even had a news clip where they were doing, like, the John Brown type behavior. That is the metaphor, but, I mean, they were doing praise these white people. They were such good white. This is my good white hippie. He was just so sweet and loving. It's like, what? I think they had criminal records. It was a report I saw one of our listeners shared it before we went on air about their criminal activity. I suspect if this had been different, they would have posted and talked about how they had strong armed robberies on their rap sheet and all the rest of it. But, yeah, I'm not doing the Heather Hare treatment either to get all said. Not that anybody here did that, but, I mean, yeah, I think he just killed some white people, like, you know, who were probably out up to no good in Wisconsin. I don't even think they lived in Wisconsin. I think they gave their addresses out, too. They didn't live there either. So, I mean, the problem is white people. Were other folks going to comment on that? Just we did have white people killed in Wisconsin.
Can I chime in?
Yes.
We'll get both of you. Robin.
Go ahead. He can go first. I'll wait.
Okay. I think that was Henry.
In Chicago. Yeah, just to confirm, he did kill two white people. And many, many people here believe he was actually charged with the murders of those white people. And many of us believe that because he did kill white people, that's why he got charged with the murder. If those were black people, he probably would have got off on self-defense. But that's all.
That's one of your neighbors. He lives right there with you. Let's see. Rob, did you have follow-up, sir?
So I didn't, like, watch the news clip. I automatically assumed that he killed black people. So now that I have the information that it was white people, I am going to watch this thing very closely. That is very interesting. And thank you for the correction.
For sure. Strive for accuracy. Try to do that. It is difficult. And it is challenging because some of the photographs, you know, I had to, like, look a little bit. I think one of the images, one of the fellas looked like he might have had locks or something so he could look like. They said, they described, like, he's my hippie white dude. He's so cool and so soulful. Yeah, suspected racist, Heather Hare, John Brown. Yeah. Yes, but be mindful. We'll see how all of this, you know, proceeds over the next few months or so. I did want to make sure that I shared, like, now somebody sent me a request for a guest. So now you should have this person as a guest on the program. That was probably not the best week since we had our guest, victim of racism, on earlier this week. His insistence that this class that is the issue was probably not the best week for this recommendation. Although I don't know what would have been a good week for this recommendation. So since the recommendation, it's a victim of racism, I've said for years the COWS is most concerned with interviewing white people. Said that for years. So this is a victim of racism. It's not that we haven't had constructive non-white people on the program, but, man, we really are about talking to white people. The problem, not Yamiche Alcindor. So I look at this victim's website. I'm not going to give the name. Victim of Racism. It doesn't even matter. Victim of Racism. So this person writes that they have four children, passionate about supporting moms dealing with everything from trying to start their own business to figuring out childcare to critically evaluating products for family, kids, to nursing while traveling for work, to talking to kids about the inequities that affect us all. Now, here we go. This is her listing, giving it to you exactly as it is. Sexism, racism, classism, cis-sexism, I don't even know what that is, ableism, etc. This is not someone who needs to be on the context of white supremacy as a guest. The C in context of white supremacy is not for classism, cis-sexism, etc. Context of white supremacy. I don't even see white supremacy listed anywhere here. So that was one. And then what really got me was I continued to look. Did I say something about cowbell before? I said something about cowbell before. So I continue to look. This person writes, my husband and I started a video series called Epicureans, and it's the adventures of a multiracial San Francisco Bay Area family. I stopped there. Now I said, wow. Now, if Gus T had a white wife and four biracial children and bragged and had photos of my biracial family out here on the West Coast, talked about all the wonderful vegan meals that we have, how much credibility would I have? And I'm going to turn around and talk about racism and then cisgender and blah, 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 everything else. How much credibility would I have? Black male with a white woman. That's what I thought. Feverish, Pam, miss you? I'd be feverish. That's what I think. So, no, this person is not going to be invited to the cows. And further, we are not having any non-white guests on the cows for the rest of the year. If that means we don't have any guests, that means we don't have any guests. We are about talking to white people. If you have a guest suggestion for a non-white person, I will catch you in 2021. I am so serious about this, I had to renege. Remember Oreo experience? White people to the rescue? She's still alive. Oh, my God. What the hell? What's going on? Let's chat with her. I reneged. She was going to be on the program, the guest this week. We are not about talking to people who are extra confused and don't even think that there's a system of white supremacy. That is not what we are about in 2020, the year of the Rona. Rest in peace to Mr. Boswick. White people are the problem. I would much rather have that dialogue if they think it's class or whatever else that they think it is, talking to white people. So hopefully Oreo experience will live until 2021. We can talk to her then. Until then, white guests only for the rest of the year. Did we miss anybody?
Here.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello from Dallas. I have a couple of other comments I'd like to make. Please, sure. Thank you. Sorry, I'm entertaining little victims, a few of them, actually. Articles I came across, not now, sir. But can you excuse me?
It's hard work. Woo! I was cracking up
laughing. Okay, yeah. My son and his dog. They are so serious.
White dog, Romaine Gary, we're finishing up.
Okay. I am entertaining little victims, so this what I discovered pertains to that. Black babies are three times more likely to die in the care of white doctors. I thought that was interesting because, in the contrast, white children, they receive the same amount of care no matter the race of the doctors. So I thought that was very interesting. That stood out to me. And I think that's, I think it's by design because black doctors, I think they have to be extra careful with their practices, because if they do make, you know, a mistake, they're subject to lose their licenses and things of that nature. It was said that white people, you know, they don't get fired, they get transferred. So, and with the pandemic going on in the medical field, I can't see anybody losing their jobs for, you know, the loss of a black child. That just wouldn't make sense in a system of white supremacy. COVID cases, there was another article that stated half of the positive tests were, this is a segment you played, half the positive tests for COVID were black and Latino. And I had a question when I heard that. Does that mean that the other half of the cases were white people? I just didn't, like, you know, they, and if it does, it seems like in that segment that you played that white people may be affected more by COVID than black people, which, if you ask me, that's an incentive for them to receive the first rounds of vaccinations. Half the positive tests are black and Latino. The other half, which is a larger portion of people, should get immediate care or the first rounds of vaccines. I support that. When renting, I thought it was interesting that in ads, advertisements that read safe or secure are for black people or in urban areas. And if you have a vintage charm, you know, this is suspected white supremacists. I noticed that because it's codification. I never thought of that before, but it does make sense. So I'm putting a pin in that. I noticed there's a famous podcaster named Joe Budden. If you ask me, this is an example of black self-respect. He was very vocal about his about not signing his, you know, renewing his contract with his company. It would be Spotify. He may be boisterous in his opinion, but he's correct. You know, if he feels that way. I agree with the level of, you know, self-respect he has for himself. I thought that was very interesting. I'm sorry for the barking if you hear it. My dog is my kid. He's little victims. And I also noticed Jason Whitlock called LeBron James a bigot, since we were talking about the NBA, for promoting racial tension and generalizing white officers shooting black people. Now, I don't agree with Jason Whitlock calling LeBron James a bigot by any means, but I do believe he is correct about, you know, LeBron, if LeBron did generalize white officers shooting black people, because I believe that all officers, if given a chance, wouldn't mind shooting a non-white black victim of racism. And I believe, like, blue suits shoot black bodies. I think it's a very common theme. No matter the race of the person wearing the suit, they seem to get praised and just kudos for victimizing a victim of racism. So I would like to say, victims beware. And I don't like finding myself in agreement with Jason Whitlock at all, nor do I agree with any of his views, but I don't think generalizing white officers is the way to go. If that's what LeBron James did, I think it's just beware of officers. They are it's safer to assume that no matter their pigment, they are race soldiers. And if you operate in that regard, you may be able to leave without getting shot in the back or something of that nature. Thank you. That's all I have. I mute my line.
Does people even say bigot anymore? I feel like that's like 1960s. Like, I don't think people say bigot too often anymore. But be that as it may, no name calling is. I think about that all the time. Like, there are many difficult, challenging aspects of countering racism, replacing white supremacy with justice. It is, I guess, baffling to me that no name calling is, wow, you are asking a lot, Fuller. Woo, we got coons and bigots and accomplices, and I mean, woo, we got all kinds of, you know, coons that just got to be called out, you know. We just got to call them all kinds of names. No name calling is on the top 10 for a reason. So if we could all, there'll be lots of examples. Mr. Whitlock is a victim of racism too, but as best we can, try to not name call. White people will promote. They'll put Mr. Whitlock on TV or YouTube or whatever it is. Give him a platform. You want to call him a bigot? Yes, indeed. Get out there. Absolutely. If you want to, Al Sharpton is a bigot too. If you got something to say about him, we'll give you an extra 10 minutes or so. But no name calling. That would be one. VGQ is also a big one too. Say that. Said that a few times today myself. VGQ. VGQ. Victims Guarantee Qualified. Hang on 1 second. Were there people that we missed totally? Just making sure that we don't have folks that got muted or missed completely. Anybody we missed didn't get a chance to speak at all?
Can I be heard?
Oh, okay. Retired firefighter.
Greetings to everyone. I also... did not fully understand on the professional entertainers who play basketball would decide to not to quote unquote go to work on one day, and a couple of days later they will report to work. I didn't read or hear anywhere where there was some understanding to that. And if that's correct, the only thing I can tally it up to is to be a quote-unquote symbolic gesture, which is not new. The only thing that I can definitely say to it, the problem more than likely still would exist further. If all individuals that are connected with the people activity of entertainment, it doesn't that meaning that it doesn't stop with sports. It goes into the people you see on television, the people you see in the movies, people who sing, dance, turn flips, bring their quote-unquote talents to an agenda that would solve the problem of racism, white supremacy. That probably would make at least a better impact on this problem globally, I would say, amongst myself also and others. That's just an observation on my behalf. I've always heard the word bigot, but I've never heard anybody state a meaning for the word. And I can only guess on what it's close to saying, that, you know, that somebody is a quote-unquote racist. But I don't know directly on... I've never heard directly on what that term is as opposed to, quote unquote, a racist. Yeah, it was just some thoughts that I had I don't have anything else to really report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. 30 seconds, I think that was Irie. If you have something, you can get in 30 seconds before we conclude.
Yeah, I was just going to say your book club, when y'all were talking about the man being infatuated with that woman named Madeline, I found it interesting that the author used that name because Madeline is actually a cartoon character I watched growing up. And it's a little girl in France. Like, I think she's a orphan or something, and she's in an orphanage that's run by nuns. So it was definitely incestuous. I just wanted to confirm that as far as that last chapter y'all read. And that was it. Thanks.
Reading more important than watching television. The book club, Romaine Gary, White Dog. We had a number of some bars that we had our plugs throughout the broadcast this evening. The sexual deviance is like every page. I'm sure there'll be more of it next week, but I mean, he's feeling up a pregnant woman. Her husband is right there, and she's young enough to be his daughter. I mean, he's married to some. Romaine Gary, Jerry Epstein, Harvey Weinstein would be proud. Let's see. We will wrap it up. We did our 3 hours plus some extra. We'll be back soon. I think we do have Dr. Ruby Lathan on the program. She's a victim of racism. I did not renege with her because I do think she has constructive info. Looking forward to chatting up with her. But white guests only rest of the year. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We need our brain computer working at maximum capacity. Kyle, written hours, getting a ride from their parents, out causing mischief. Got to be sober. Be alert. I said that all year long. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. I will say again, man, there are many, many reasons to stay home. In addition to the Rona, 1,200 cases, they said, in Alabama. Roll Tide. UNC the same. They opened school up, I think, for like 2 days and then shut things back down. Many reasons to stay in the house. Whites would be at the top of the list. If you got to go out, something essential, you are having a slumber party for your offspring, you're going to work, whatever else that is important, serious things, no problem. Be very aware, hyper really, aware of your surroundings. Be paying attention. If it looks like a white person is getting hostile, aggressive, we are not having any sort of verbal altercations or anything like that with any white people. It is all evasive. Getting out of here, assume that this white person could be armed, especially if they are looking to escalate, getting loud. Not at all. And they might have friends, all of that. Anything looks like that, consider it dangerous. It's no need to take any risks. It's already been a super, super dangerous year. With that, we're sober. If you're going out, you're buckled and hyper alert. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Again, just doing everything we can, number one, to minimize contact with race soldiers and trying to make sure we have all of our attention, paying attention to what's going on around us. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.